call the conference committee on House File 2362 to order. Representative Lencheski, you suggested that the Senate consider a sixth conference committee member, and I've talked it over with some of our conferees, and they have suggested to me that we have a member of the Senate who's spent pretty knowledgeable in the tax area and former chair of the committee that would probably love to participate. So why don't you mull that over and see if you'd like to consider our offer.
Senator Bach. Senator Bach, we met a conferee in training. And a trainer.
That could be up for discussion.
Oh, but we'll mull that over. We'll take that under consideration.
Mull that over. Enjoy your coffee cups. The Senate came bearing gifts.
Senator Bach, I want to thank you, as all the members of the House do, for this incredible regal mug. State Senator Tom Bach. He's got his own mugs.
It's microwavable gold. Costs extra money. And it's also dishwasher safe. That also is a little additional feature of it.
Well, Senator Bach, as you know, Representative Dietrich has said the House will not be outdone
tomorrow.
So stay tuned. We'll think of something. We don't know yet, but seriously, we appreciate this.
No, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Where do we have our House? Do you call it council over there, or do you call it research?
We're research. I think you're council. Is that right? We call it. We could start council if you'd like.
We're on page 11. I think we'll continue through the side-by-side section 15.
Oh, yes, maybe.
Yeah, we probably should. Senator Mois is not here because she's in judiciary, which she chairs, and maybe we should come back to that. I know she's got some real interest in that section. So we could go to section, and if somebody could just remind us to come back to that one. And she'll be here a little bit later today, so it would be good if we could kind of revisit that a little bit later. Section 16 of the House bill. Mr. Baker, I guess that would probably be yours.
Yep.
It was when I was over there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're on page 12, section 16. This has several different provisions in it. The first one increases the homestead resorts, it increases the homesteaded resorts first tier from $500,000 to $600,000. And then it also decreases the class rate from 0.55 to 0.50. So it will have the same class rate as agriculture, because ag homesteads also, later on you'll see that the House also changed that to 0.50. The resort definition that's here is the resort definition that is the Department of Revenue's that came out of that task force that the 2005 legislature asked the department to look into, and that is their language. And then in the disabled homesteads, the class 1B, they get a class rate of 0.45 on the first 32,000. That was increased to 50,000 in this section. And then the language was stricken relating to the veterans homesteads, because we don't need it any longer because of the changes made later on in section 21.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate has the same resort definition change in Article 14, Section 34, and the same provision relating to veterans' homesteads because of the exemption later on in Section 24 of Article 5.
Section 17 is the ag homesteads and rural land or rural vacant land class. This is where the House changed the class rate from the 0.55 to 0.50 on the first tier. And the Senate, I see, did the same
Mr. Chairman, the Senate did the same class rate change for Ag Homestead. Mr. Chairman,
I don't remember the Senate raising the first tier number. Did we do both?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the first tier is indexed.
Yes.
For ag land, ag homestead property. So every year that goes up. It was 600,000. It was indexed up to 690, and then it's going to 790 for taxes payable in 2008.
So this is the just the index number?
Right. That's current just current law.
That's current law.
Okay. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the House. This was a Senator Langseth provision. I don't know who got the green jackets on that over there. I was curious. It's a pretty reasonable thought that we might take a look at increasing the first tier for ag. Just wondering if the bill would be heard.
Mr. Chair, that was the Langseth bill that I carried in the House. And the indexing is from actually 06 legislation that it moves up now with inflation. It was 690,000 first year, now it goes to 790 for next year. So that's already in current law. That's just moving.
In a one-year inflation is $100,000?
It's trying to catch up. To it went back maybe...
It's tied to the increase in ag values, and ag values have been going up very rapidly, so it's not tied to general inflation.
Senator Vaughn, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jessica.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael, my memory, and I maybe I'm wrong on this, was this Representative Dorman's bill? Maybe Representative Simpson knows.
There were several different authors. Representative Dorman had a bill that would have indexed this back. It would have indexed it back several years, and I think it would have actually increased it to close to $1 million had this bill passed.
Mr. Chair, I think this is Representative Welty and Representative Demmer. Representative Marquardt. I think they all had a piece of this one.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and to the committee, you're right about that. I was actually referring to the Article 6, Section 3, where we were increasing the market value credit.
Oh, you're going to the next one. Okay.
I thought that's where Mr. Paulson was at.
This is the market value, too.
Mr. Paulson, tell us about the Senate provision, Article 6, Section 3.
Mr. Chairman, Article 6, Section 3 increases the market value tier for the agricultural land market value credit. It's currently $115,000. It increases to $150,000. The credit rate is 0.3%, and so the credit maximum increases from $345 to $450.
Representative Marquardt, it sounds like a good idea.
Mr. Chair, that part would be fine. We eliminated the residential market value homestead credit, phased it out after 3 years, and replaced it with our... By the way, Mr. Chair, you brought us cups. We brought you the people's voice today. Here's the booklet with the 750 comments from residents, so just keep it handy so we stay grounded to what we're here all about today.
We'll be looking forward to a summary of it.
Mr. Chairman?
If we could summarize it into like six little provisions.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Marquardt, read this on the House floor.
Mr. Chair, I did read. I read about five of them.
Only about five. I thought it was going on for a long time.
We would have been there a few more hours had I read them all.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to add that although the House did not increase the market value ag credit, the House did create a new agricultural credit on the school debt levy side that's about $10 million a year, but it is in the K-12 bill, not in this bill.
So how many other tax provisions is the House carrying in their education bill?
Senator Bach.
Representative Chesky?
We have anything related to school levies is in our K-12 bill. Beyond that, nothing.
And Mr. Chair, just the, if I could, what Mr. Hines mentioned on the debt service aid, what it would be is that 23% of whatever is on an agricultural land's debt service for school bonding issue, that would be aid that would come in covered from the state, so it would not shift on to any other properties. It would literally be cover 23% of whatever that debt service is on ag land. So it's about $10 million statewide.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, the next section, well, it's still part of Section 17, is rural vacant land. This is the establishment of the new rural vacant land class that was recommended by the Department of Revenue Task Force, and it was intended or is intended to improve uniformity. And this subclass is an unplatted rural real estate consisting of at least 10 acres, but it's not used for ag products, and it's an ancillary non-residential structure like a hunting shack does not disqualify the property from this class.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate has the same rural land provision. There's a little language difference between concerning the ancillary structures, but it's minor.
So, Mr. Paulson, does the Senate language allow a 40-acre piece with a hunting shack to be in this classification?
Mr. Chairman, as long as it's meets the definition of an ancillary structure, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate bill also has includes in the rural land class land that's enrolled in the aggregate resource preservation property tax law. It's in Section 16. There'll be more explanation on that, a fairly lengthy explanation. Actually, it's on page 27 of the summary. Maybe we should wait until we get there.
There's other changes made to the rural vacant land subclass, but it's just reference changes because of the change that I just spoke of.
And Mr. Chairman, the Senate has an additional provision that rural woodland property that's under a forest management plan but is not in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act has a class rate of 0.55%, and it cannot exceed 1,920 acres, and the owners must apply annually to the county assessor. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the Senate bill includes short rotation woody crops within the definition of agricultural products. That's also in this section.
And the House doesn't have anything on the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act language that the Senate has. And the House didn't ever take up the bill or discuss the short rotation woody crops to any degree. So it didn't ever get included in the report.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Simpson.
Just a comment or a thought. It seems that we're doing a lot of reclassification and bringing these percentages down to 0.50 just for common ground. Is there a reason that the Senate went to 0.55 on the Sustainable Forest Act, or why they didn't just go to the 0.50?
I think Senator Skoy can just probably address that, but I think currently we're at 1%.
Okay.
On timberland, Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, yes, and I suppose it would be, it could be that we would move it down with the ag land, but we currently didn't do that on our rural woodlands, and we were just trying to give people incentive to be part of the Sustainable Forest Incentive. I think it's a good program, mm-hmm. And you know, we could look at whether that should be consistent with ag if we are able to accomplish that. You know, Mr. Chair,
sir, go ahead.
While we're talking about the rural woodlands and the short rotation woody crops, you know, this rural vacant lands class that we're establishing here in what the Senate Property Tax Division did, really was kind of part of the Green Acres overhaul we did, and also the seasonal rec change that we're going to be coming to shortly. It kind of all works together, and you know, start doing a lot of changes to you know, that whole package of assessors, land classifications, department recommendations. It doesn't work as well, so we'd like to kind of work on this stuff in concert, because when you're thinking about these rural lands, I think you have to keep the Green Acres part of ag in mind, and a big part of the change is taking the seasonal rec and moving to non-homestead residential, and then that rural lands fits in pretty well with that then. So I think we should kind of look at it in that light if we can.
Section 18 is utility property. This is in response to the rules that were adopted by the department, and they will be phased in, but the house has an increase in the current class rate on personal property attached machinery for the electric generation system, and it goes from 2% to 3% effective in pay 08. And then the class rate on transmission and distribution systems that's at 2% will go to 2.25%. And this particular is all systems that are part of pipeline and water, gas, crude oil, petroleum products, and or that are part of an electric transmission or distribution system. So they'll increase from the 2 to 2.25. Immediately for PA08.
And Mr. Chairman, the Senate, Section 26, delays and phases in the class rate changes. The Senate goes to 2.5% for taxes payable in 2009, 3% for taxes payable in 2010 on the electric generation systems, and on the transmission and distribution systems, increases to 2.15% for taxes payable in 2009 and 2.25% for taxes payable in 2010.
Well, Mr. Manson, I believe the reason the Senate phased in the class rate change was that the rule change was being phased in. Do I remember that correctly? And did the House?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The rule will be phased in over 3 years, beginning with assessment 07.
And Representative Chesky, is there a reason that the House didn't phase in the class rate increase?
Well, Senator Bach, I think what we did is we took Representative Wolschlager's bill as is. I think you must have changed. Was it Senator Murphy was your author? And so you obviously changed his bill a little bit and took in the phase in. You know, we'd have to think about that, but I think probably your language probably works a little better than ours. I know that the governor had supplemental recommendations in this area as well, after the February forecast, and I think he was moving some money around too, except for one city, which I believe was Red Wing, because they had signed what they call an RSA. I don't know what that stands for, but they tried to sign an agreement, I guess, with the utilities initially, and then I think the utilities feel like they had a deal, and Red Wing would say no, they felt pressure, but they felt that that deal wasn't sufficient. But I think the governor's recommendation at that area was to provide some more aid. Maybe Mr. Manson can tell us that, to those cities, but they left out Red Wing, which we thought was sort of actually punitive, and we weren't sure what the governor was proposing there. But I think because we were a little bit confused about the governor's supplemental recommendations in that area, that we just decided to take Representative Wolschlager's language as is. But I don't know if Representative Marquardt would want to get involved in this too, but I don't. It seems the net effect for these cities probably isn't any different. So I don't know if Mr. Manson wants to comment on what the governor was recommending in his supplemental recommendations. I think that was a wrinkle for us.
Mr. Manson?
And
I do appreciate that the governor in his supplemental budget recognized that the whole cities really are going to have a problem here.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that information with me, but he was recommending transitional aid for those cities that have, I think, impacts over 2.5%, I believe it was, in lost revenue. But I don't have that detail with me, but it was like the top five cities. And I can provide for you. It's back in my office.
Representative Diedrich, what do you think? Senate a little more thoughtful on this than the House?
Yes.
Good answer. Counsel?
Can't lie.
The next section, 19, first thing is non-homestead duplexes and triplexes. What it does is it moves the non-homestead, both A and non-A duplexes and triplexes, into class 4BB, which is the class that right now consists of the single unit non-homestead. And duplexes and triplexes have a class rate of 1.25%, and the class rate will be 1% with this change if to the same as the class 4BB.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate does not make any change on the duplexes and triplexes.
Yeah.
Representative Markwart, was there a bill on this? Or yeah. we don't remember seeing this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that was Representative Loeffler's bill. And also, the vacant land in this classification would remain the same at 1.25, so that we would not create an incentive to keep that land vacant. It gives an incentive to develop that land. But that did come from Representative Loeffler, and I don't know if there was a companion in the Senate or not.
Yeah. The next provision is the community service-oriented organizations, and this is the provision that expands that 4C class to the nonprofit community service-oriented organizations that make charitable contributions and donations that are at least equal to the previous year's property taxes. And basically, this is to address VFWs and American Legions, Knights of Columbus properties. And it's keyed into the charitable contribution and donation definitions, which are used for lawful gambling. And they will have a class rate of 1.5% and subject to the state general rate for seasonal rec, which is a 40% rate, about, or 20%. As opposed to right now, they're treated like commercial property, and which commercial property has a class rate of 1.5% on the first 150 and the 2% on the excess. So they'll get a class rate reduction, plus the state general tax rate is lower. So they'll get a pretty significant decrease.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate has the same provision, Section 27.
And then the last...
Mr. Chair, just as an example, we took a VFW in Forest Lake that had property taxes of $47,000. And this change, which also looks like is in the Senate, would reduce that by about $20,000. It would be then $27,000. So it's quite a significant benefit to those service clubs. Just to give you a perspective of what it does.
Representative Markwart, the Senate Tax Committee didn't think this was all that good an idea. And it was added on the floor of the Senate by Senator Vandeveer, a very close division vote. So we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it. I don't remember us hearing it in committee, so we'll have to give it some consideration. The truth is that $20,000 shifts onto somebody.
Yeah.
Counsel?
The last minor thing is just resort definition. That's just, again, part of the Department of Revenue's task force that happens to be in the same section.
And, Mr. Chairman, the Senate has the same provision in Article 14, Section 25. Mr. Chairman, the next section is on the Senate side. It's the bill eliminates the separate property class for the non-commercial seasonal recreation the cabin property. And so the cabins just become a part of residential non-homestead property. Then I guess the next two sections are also on the Senate side. Article 5, Section 3 strikes the exemption for a seasonal recreational property from referendum market value tax base. Under current law, cabins are subject to the state levy and not to the referendum. This would reverse that. It's part of making them the same as residential non-homestead. And the next provision, Section 27, bill includes property up to 3 acres that's located on a lake and operated as a restaurant within the commercial seasonal class, and it's has the provisions of not being devoted to commercial purposes more than 250 days per year and must receive 60% of gross receipts during 4 consecutive months.
I should say, Representative Lencheski, the Senate Tax Committee didn't spend a lot of time on Section 27 either, because that was added on this. Did we add that in? I guess we added it on the markup of the bill, but we never actually had any testimony on it. But when we marked the bill up, that was offered on behalf of Senator Gimsey, I believe.
Senator Bach. That was Representative Marquardt's bill in the House.
And it's not in the House
not
tax
in
bill?
Here. No.
Representative Marquardt, what happened?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, you know, every once in a while you have to reevaluate when you certain things. I just thought about it a little bit more and just didn't quite, it wasn't ready for prime time for this tax committee.
Would you express that to Senator Gimsey on my behalf?
Well, maybe Senator Langseth on the other one.
Is he on?
Okay. But it's something we haven't spent any time on. We didn't have any public testimony on. We don't know how many parcels of this kind of property there are.
Senator Bach, I think part of the concern we had, we did have testimony, but we started thinking about folks who have restaurants on Lake Minnetonka and places like that, and we were trying to think through how this might work, and maybe all the conferees need to have a field trip this summer. Start looking at some of these restaurants on the lake and see if we think this is a good idea.
Yeah, we don't know how many properties this impacts, but it doesn't, at first blush, it doesn't seem unreasonable, but we didn't have any testimony on it either. Council?
Section 20 is just a technical change for the rural vacant land class.
Moving on to Section 21, the House bill dealing with the with disabled veterans, and the House kind of merged two proposals, one from Representative Eastland and one from Representative Rukavina, together into the omnibus bill package. And what we created was a three-tiered exemption for disabled veterans. The first tier being when a veteran with a 50% disability, 50 to 70% disability, gets a $100,000 market value exclusion from their value in determining their tax. Then from 70% or greater up to 100% gets a $150,000 exclusion. And finally, if it's a permanent, total and permanent disability, then it's a $300,000 exemption. And I think I'll.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate bill does not have a schedule under the Senate bill. If the veteran has total and complete, total and permanent disability, it's a complete property tax exemption, and there's no provision for a veteran with a partial or temporary disability.
Now I understand why the House tracks more money savings from the property tax refund because of the way you phase this in. Because I think you track some more money than the Senate does on your spreadsheet on this provision, which are savings in the PTR program. Representative Marquardt?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to have it down to partial disability, because I was doing some research on this. Department of Veterans Affairs, a lot of times they will not list a disabled veteran as total and permanent because of the possibility that they may not be permanent. So then they get a lesser rating. So when you have total and permanent, there might be a number that would be totally disabled but may not qualify necessarily for this. So if you're at 50 or 70, you do have, I think it provides more options there and provides more relief to, you know, more veterans who may not be totally and permanent. When you put both of those in there, it does give that flexibility.
Senator Squire, do we have a bill on the partial disabled? I'm assuming there was a separate bill.
I don't think it included this partial.
Was there a separate bill?
Yes, do you have the bill for the Senate authorized?
Well, I don't see that there. But, Mr. Chair, the House bill, the estimate, it would be 13, would affect 13,000 disabled veterans, and in the Senate bill, 3,430 disabled veterans.
Can we find out if there was a Senate companion?
It looks like research is saying there was not.
That was about 2360.
These were bills brought by Representative Rukavina and Representative Eastland. Kind of a combination there.
Eastland's bill.
Representative Eastland. We don't know. Representative Rukavina's bill makes money. Yeah.
Representative Rukavina's bill was Senator Bach's bill.
Has it always been Senator Bach? Because Representative Rukavina's had that bill a long time.
Representative Rukavina decided this year he wanted to get it done, so he sent it to me instead of somebody else. Representative Dietrich?
Yes.
A lesson in this. If you want to have a provision prevail, you might want to have a Senate companion to your bill. So we never had an opportunity to see this. Did we, Senator Swain? Partial part. Not that we don't like it, but it would be helpful if we had, if the Senate had an opportunity to see the provisions for today. Representative Simpson.
Senator Bach, I think Representative Rukavina has had this bill probably at least 3, maybe 4 years, and he keeps coming back and coming back, so I was really hoping his senator counterpart would have it this year so that we could move it. So.
Well, I think the Senate has 100% disabled, which I believe was Representative Rukavina's bill. I think what we're talking about is a second bill that allowed for partial.
And that was Representative Eastland.
Who
we don't know if he had a Senate author.
We don't know if he had a Senate author.
Possibly.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment that that's a two-way street in terms of your lesson.
Absolutely.
Dealing with a number of
points. Well made.
Senator Bach, does that mean that you're willing to chief author any of my bills on the Senate side? Were you making an offer here?
Representative Dietrich, I can take you to my office, and if we pull out the bottom drawer on the right-hand side, there are a number of yellow jackets in there that House members sent over to me that I didn't think were that good an ideas. And some
checking.
Of them are Representative Rukavina's. And Senator Tomasoni has a drawer just like it with some of Representative Rukavina's bills.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've learned why we have so many amendments in certain committees with Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair?
It is in all seriousness, it is helpful if there is a companion in the other body so that both bodies get a chance to look at what we're doing. And whether we put it in or not, I guess our individual committee's choices, but it helps if people have a chance to see. I didn't know. I was wondering why the House was tracking so much additional money over what the Senate had for this 100% disabled, and now I understand why. So, I mean, not that we might not, this is probably a very good idea. It's just a matter of, I don't know if it, 50% is the right number, or if it's 40, or if it's 60, or, you know, I understand 100, but.
Mr. Chair. According to staff, the Eastland bill did have a Senate companion, Senator Olson, 1882.
Well, that's helpful.
Olson or Olson?
O-L-S-O-N.
It could be Jen or it could be Mary.
Jen Olson?
1882.
We have two Olsons.
Olson.
Is it Olson?
There's Olson.
Senator Olsen.
We'll ask him.
We thought we had problems in the House with Haas and Hosh and Howells, and they're all Larrys.
They're all Larrys.
Wow.
Yeah, it's strange.
Well, that's helpful. But it is, I really would like to do something in this area. I think it's the right thing to do. And Council?
Mr. Chairman, one other provision that wasn't mentioned is Section 24 that eliminates a current law provision that gives a reduced class rate for property occupied by a disabled veteran if it's a special housing unit or a special facilities for disability.
The next Section 22 is a supplemental notice of proposed levy increases. This requires cities with populations over 2,500 or counties that propose levy increases greater than a threshold increase that is calculated in this next clause to mail out a proposed supplemental notice to each taxpayer. And in paragraph B, it defines what threshold increase is, and what it's getting at is your current year's levy adjusted for inflation and population and growth in market value due to new construction. If your proposed levy is greater than that, then the supplemental notice has to show what your levy was in the previous year, what your threshold levy increase is, what the proposed property tax increase, and the amount by which the proposed increase exceeds it. So it's trying to get at a number that is designed to account for inflation and market value increases in population, and saying if you levy greater than that, then you have to show the taxpayer what it is, and then it must contain a description of why you need to raise your property taxes above this threshold amount and how you plan to spend the additional revenue. So it's a form of a levy limit in a way for increases over what is through this adjustment.
Senator, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Mr. Speaker. So if you're in a rural area that has relatively flat property values and your levy goes up, you're very likely to have the opportunity to send this notice out. But if you're in a faster-growing area, you probably would be able to keep your levy underneath and you wouldn't have to expend this money. Am I clear on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, first of all, it's only for cities over 2,500 and counties. So it addresses the same category of taxing jurisdictions as the levy limits used to address. So it's not addressing small cities. It's not addressing, you know, your townships. So you are right in that if you have this rural area, you know, they would not have to. And I guess the whole logic behind that is when you have smaller areas, they're closer to the people and they kind of know what levy increases are for, and I think that was the premise of a lot of levy limit issues too for the small cities and towns.
Exactly.
And Mr. Chair, but the counties are subject to this, so
yes.
Kitson County would be.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, this has to do, and this was put in for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, when you get to that truth in taxation, trying to get more people involved and getting more accountability out to taxpayers. But in our bill, for example, we were directing about $440 million of property tax relief and about $223 million directly to the homeowner. And we thought, you know, a number of things, but we thought this was a fair way that if you're going over a certain threshold, that you got to do a little extra accountability, and it's set, you know, it doesn't limit anything, but it does say that you've got to, if you go over a threshold, you've got to say why you're going over, why you need to go over that threshold, and what you plan to spend the money on. So it does create some accountability, and I think that's a good step.
How does the League of Cities feel,
Mr. Chair? I have not received letters of endorsement from the various local units of government on this one.
I don't think we took any testimony on this, so I was just curious. But
Senator Bach, there wasn't a bill. This was my idea, and I didn't have a bill. It appeared
it became clear to me as we were thinking about how we could do both LGA and township aid and county aid, direct payments to local units of government, coupled with direct relief to individuals, that some might argue, I think erroneously, that this would encourage spending. So I wanted to apply a mechanism to ensure that didn't happen. I don't think increases to LGA or county aid or township aid or what we're doing in our House bill, on, in addition to all those, will cause local units of government to go out and spend wildly, but I think everybody here knows that there are many who do think that. So I actually think the net effect of this isn't much. I think most cities and counties are very responsible, and if they're looking at their current levy plus population plus inflation plus new growth, I think they're okay. It's not prohibitive, even if they have to do a supplemental notice. It says they just have to say to their constituency, we're going a little further than that, here's why. I think the converse, you know, the argument of we could do nothing, but that sort of opens the door to the folks that aren't trusting of local units of government. And having been a former city council member and one who is trusting, I thought from my perspective as a former city council member, this was pretty reasonable. And I think it allows people to put the brakes on. If the argument is that somehow when people get property tax relief, locally elected officials will become irresponsible, you know, it's not one I'd make, but it's one that many make, and this would prevent that. And I don't have any fear of it being a problem because I don't anticipate that that's what local units of government will do.
Representative Lencheski, I never meant to imply that having to have a bill or a companion to have something incorporated in this bill applied to the chairman. So I understand that. And you may have a good idea. But I think at some point before we incorporate it, we kind of want to hear from the cities, I think.
Yeah. Senator Bach, one other thing. I was driving in today, and I heard the governor on the radio today, and he actually was talking a little bit about this, not this provision. But I heard him get asked, you know, what about this idea of new revenues to pay for property tax relief? And I have to admit I didn't hear it all. But one of the things he talked about is that he'd be open to that if there was ways to somehow control growth in property taxes, caps, you know, whether they're levy limits or something like this or freezes or something else. I thought it was interesting that the governor seemed open to some of the proposals that the Senate and the House have here as long as he felt there could be some caps. And so I heard him discussing that today on the radio. So I don't know. Well, maybe later the governor's office will come and tell us what they might think of a provision like this, or maybe even just define for the conferees what kind of mechanism he's referencing. Because, you know, we all know there's light levy limits, there's hard levy limits, there's the old levy limits back in the day, there's the new ones, and then there's things that are as extreme as Tabor and things that we had the crinky, remember, the turbo charge, we had the postcards. We've had all kinds of ideas, so we might want to get assistance from the governor's office on what exactly he thinks is a market, as a property tax cap. You know, if it's a hard property tax freeze, I don't know. But it might be interesting to know what the governor's office is thinking in that regard.
For sure. Representative Marker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had wonderful testimony from the local units of government this year. And I cited this on the House floor the other day. But, you know, local units of government are not overspending. And if you look, in fact, from what we received from the various groups, charts, is that if you take, and this was from the price of government and departments of finance and or revenue, I can't remember, I don't have it in front of me, but if you looked at the total city's revenues that they took in and spent, if you adjusted that to inflation, the counties, rural cities, and metro cities all were from 2002 levels minus between like 5% and 7% of their revenue from 02 levels under inflation adjusted. So you do hear a lot that these local units of government are overspending, and I think we have to make sure that that's not the case. But I do think something like this is always good to have. I think the more accountability you can put out there, and I think the more cities and local units of government explain to folks why they're spending things and why I think is a good idea.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, we also heard very good testimony with regard to that. There's two lines to that graph that you should also have talked about. As the revenues were below zero, the line that shows the aids going down and the levies going up by very comparable amounts. And it was striking that all the jurisdictions had very comparable information that they presented to the committee.
Council?
The next provision is the joint public hearings. This allows counties to hold a joint public TNT hearing with the governing bodies of all the taxing authorities that are partially or wholly located in the county that are required to hold a public hearing. This is Representative Marquardt's provision. And this only applies to counties outside the 7 metro area, and the participation in it is totally voluntary. The joint hearing is held on the first Thursday in December, and that's the day that counties are scheduled right now to hold their hearing. And a single newspaper advertisement for the county and any city or school district that's participating would be in lieu of individual advertisements. And the idea here is that the county board would find a space and all of the meetings would be held. There'd be a county meeting for 30 minutes or so, and then a city. Then people would divide up into the various cities and then school districts and then come back together at the end of that. And it's so that everybody is in one place. And it's partially to get around the whole issue of kind of finger-pointing of, you know, it's your fault, so that if everybody is in one place. And it also helps that taxpayers only have to go one night. They can do the county, city, and school all at one time and don't have to go to three separate hearings. So I don't know if...
What do you think, Representative Margaret?
Well, Mr. Chair,
where did this come from?
In December, rather than heading off to a local basketball game, wrestling match, or hockey, you could go to 2 hours of truth and taxation meetings.
That sounds fun.
And what this would do is, it's actually to increase accountability, but also participation. Where, if you've got property tax owners that are really interested in this, they can do it all in one night. And your county and city and school boards are all there together, so you know they can. A lot of times, so many things you go to, it's because of something else. Oh, that's another night, and I missed that. So put them all together, and I think it would increase accountability, but also I'm hoping some participation that they could all kind of a one-stop shop and get her done.
Representative Marquardt, would they all come to the consensus and blame the legislature?
Mr. Chair, probably we should add another half hour for your legislators to be there, too, but I didn't put that in there. But, yeah, they could. You'd probably want to be there, Senator Bach, because they might talk about you.
The first Thursday in December. I'll look at my calendar. Was this a bill?
Yeah, yes.
Representative Marquardt.
Senator Squire.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't remember any discussions about this, but you know, if they would agree to the Senate's provisions on property taxes, there would be such significant reductions that these meetings would be very poorly attended.
Or wouldn't be held at all.
They wouldn't be held at all.
They have to be held now.
What was the threshold?
I thought if they were below such a percentage.
Isn't there a threshold, Joel?
You don't reduce your employees at all.
Yeah.
The next section 24 is the 60-day rule, and what this has to do with is right now in statute the language for what information is required in cases where a petitioner contests valuation on income-producing property is fairly ambiguous. The language is it doesn't get specific to what is it that you really need prior to filing in the tax petitions in tax court. And all this language does is it makes it real clear that these are the items that are needed for the 60-day rule, you know, prior to the 60 days that are needed for assessors. And this was Representative Markwart's bill.
Mr. Chair, the problem on this one, and Ms. Baker kind of alluded to it, is that what would happen is a business would hand in all their information into the assessor, and then in that 60-day window of time, and then after the 60 days was completed, the assessor would say, oh, you didn't give me this information. And if, in fact, they don't have the information, then the tax judge has to dismiss that. And so what this does is just clarifies the information that would be needed to the assessor so that there isn't kind of a gotcha towards the end.
Did you send the yellow jacket phone to your senator?
There is no Senate companion. No Senate companion.
You're the chair of the division. You're okay. Ms. Baker?
Why don't you do the monthly?
Mr. Chairman, Section 25 of the House provision requires counties to offer an option for homestead property to pay their property taxes in eight equal monthly installments starting May 15th through December 15th. And it does this by requiring each county to establish a procedure for how this could be done within the county's own sort of financial structure that address how homeowners would need to get into the program, whether there would be payment plans like automatic withdrawals, et cetera. So it leaves it up to the counties to develop a plan to make this thing work. That's the gist of it. We would have liked to have gone to 12 payments, but because the tax statements aren't ready till, it wouldn't be really practical to get anything before May 15th. So that's why it ended up at 8 monthly payments.
So, Markwart, I have often thought that one of the reasons that citizens hate property taxes is they have to pay them in these two large lump sums, you know, unless it's somehow on their mortgage. And I wondered, any thought that this might alleviate some of the animosity towards property taxes?
Mr. Chair, of course, a number pay out of their escrow, so they never really see that. But this was a citizen's bill that they just felt it was more difficult to come up with those two bigger payments. And so they thought if they could do it monthly, they could plan for it and do that. Now, I don't have a stack of letters of endorsement on this one also from the county. They have a few concerns.
So this is number two of the citizens?
This was number two.
Number three, I think.
Did we get by one then?
Didn't we have one last night?
Yeah, we had one last night.
Right.
This old house.
Oh, the rural, excuse Mr. Chair, rural vacant land actually came out of the citizens one also. Is that the three we've covered so far? We have three more to go.
And
disabled homestead was a fourth one. So that from 32,000 to 50,000 on that first tier on disabled.
So we're at number four now.
We should have two more coming.
Did we get?
We got two of the four on our own.
Without a website.
You were just lucky.
Must have been the campaign season.
Representative Markwart, these citizens' provisions, were they incorporated in a citizens' bill and introduced, or who was the Senate author? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, there was no Senate author. It's just the House. It's the House bill.
It's very intriguing idea. I'm serious.
Page 18, Section 26. This is increasing the market value from $200,000 to $500,000 for commercial and industrial property for confession of judgments. That $200,000 has been out there for many years, and that came to Representative Markwart that if that should be raised to $500,000. And if you
Mr. Chairman, Section 32 of the Senate bill is the same.
Section 27, this allows partial payments to be made for payment of delinquent taxes, and they're credited in the same way. Right now, under law, it says that you have to pay it in full, and this is the one that it just struck the word full so that counties can accept partial payments. They can do it for current taxes, but this allows it also for delinquent taxes.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate Article 5 has the same provision in Sections 33 and 34, and in addition, the Senate allows a property tax refund to be applied against delinquent taxes for the year that the refund was payable. County boards are authorized to allow PTR claims to be allowable for claimants that would otherwise be ineligible because they have a delinquency.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this last provision that the House doesn't have a comparable provision with, we were working with the auditors to see if there wasn't a way to, as we were moving toward partial payments, to allow landowners to use their PTR to also be applied as a partial payment. I understand the department does have some concerns about the administration of this provision, so we'd have to hear from them at some point to see if it's a...
Senator Bach.
Representative Lindquist.
Senator Skye. So currently you can't do this. The state won't send you a PTR if you're delinquent, and I guess, you know, I don't think the state should. Now, if I'm understanding, you're saying some of these, is it the local units of government wish they'd get some revenue this way and get some of their taxes paid this way from the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lencheski, if the property was qualified for PTR, they would get to use the PTR against their delinquent property.
Well, referral, wasn't it? Senator Bach and Chair Bach and Senator Skye, I guess it's basically the state then paying these folks who are supposed to pay their taxes. The state's going to pay their taxes for them. They're delinquent. Right? I mean, it's going to come out of the state pot. I guess the concern I'd have there is if the idea is to help the local units recapture some of their taxes they're not getting, I think the revenue recapture works that those social service items first, like child welfare, and so I don't really know that they'd get it. I mean, maybe we didn't. I don't think we had any testimony on it. Maybe we need to learn more.
Yeah, this is a provision the Auditors Association brought to us, and in the intervening time since the Senate tax bill was passed, we've had some discussions with the department. This does have some administrative issues. We'll have to hear from the auditors and the department.
Ms. Baker?
Senator, the other thing that got brought up on this issue in some of the discussions is that manufactured homes, they can file for property tax refund. However, in the case of manufactured homes, there you have a personal debt because your property tax is a personal debt because if something happens, you have to go against that person because you can't go against the property because it's a personal property assessment. In the case of real estate, personal property or property taxes are not a personal debt. They are a lien on the property, and so that those dollars can be collected. If the property goes delinquent and forfeited, you're going to collect those dollars. And so there's a fairly significant difference between a manufactured home debt versus the other. And so that was another part of the discussion that for not going with this. The next section, 28, this has to do with requiring the commissioner to provide a reference to property tax refunds on the cover of the individual income tax instruction booklet. And also information on income eligibility and maximum refund amounts within the instruction booklet itself. This came about as part of a discussion with Representative Loeffler and Representative Sarah Anderson. Were asked to join together and talk about some of these provisions that right now taxpayers are not aware of a lot of the programs that are out there. You know, as far as the targeting, the property tax refund, the senior deferral, And this was one attempt to say we need to get the message out, we need to make sure that people are filing for these refunds, and there wasn't anything on the income tax return or the income tax instruction booklet that said anything about property tax refunds. And so the idea, and you'll see there's another place farther on in at the end of our article that also addresses this same thing of making sure that taxpayers who are eligible actually receive the refunds that they're entitled to receive.
I know we had a discussion about county auditors either putting on the property tax statement or enclosing with the property tax statement a notice.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I thought we had something in the bill on it, but it's been so long ago. The Senate mm-hmm. passed their bill in March. It's been so long, but I don't remember.
Senator Bach, I think one of the discussions on that was counties were very concerned about putting any more in the envelopes because of weight, because they said, you know, to the degree that we have to add another sheet of paper in there means that we get kicked into the next weight for mailing. And I can't remember, some of the counties came in with how many thousand dollars it would cost additional to mail their property tax statements. So that was one of the discussions. And so the House was looking for any way possible to make sure that people that are eligible for refunds know about them.
Well, I think Senator Scoy reminded me, Senator Johnson brought it up, that Anoka County, I believe, does send something out either on the statement.
Yes, and Ramsey.
It's a tear-off
piece
on the
very, yeah.
property taxes.
Senator Bach, Ramsey County has two little inserts, and they're bright colored. One is a, I think it's aqua, and one is orange. So, I mean, you open it up, and you really see these things. And one even has dollar signs all over it that says, you know, state refunds. And it's very apparent, you know, very eye-catching. But a lot of counties say that this would cost them a lot of extra dollars. And so I think these members, when they were looking into it, they were just looking for different avenues of getting the word out.
Well, Representative Lucheski, I think we are interested in increasing participation in the property tax refund program. So I think it's a good discussion for us to have how we could best accomplish that.
And Senator Bach, we spent a lot of time talking about that too. I mean, that I mean, you've got it exactly right. That's what we're trying to do, is to grow participation. You know, I recall the last couple of years here, we discussed letting cities and counties put in inserts for other reasons, like to justify what their levy increases were. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Michael can recall what the outcome of that was. I mean, my city's been doing it for years, and I don't think they ever thought they needed legislation to do it. I mean, as long as they're paying the postage. And Ramsey County's been mailing things, and so there are a lot of cities and counties that are promoting what they're going to spend that levy on, but also then mention, you know, that you can potentially get the state refund. I know I shared with the property tax division, maybe Ms. Sen later tomorrow or something can provide for the committee something I mail to my district every year. And we kind of had this discussion. I mean, I actually raise private funds, mail my whole district. How do you get the property state refund? And we were just thinking about that, you know, some parts of the state have a lot of information because either their cities or counties or their legislators are working very hard to make sure their residents understand they may qualify. And it shouldn't take that, you know. It shouldn't be disparate around the state that some people know about this and some don't. And it does seem that the responsibility of the state, not shifting the burden down to the cities or the counties or individual legislators or council members, to let their residents know about this item. And so we do want to do something to make sure all Minnesotans know. And so we thought the straight-up way was to put it on the form, you know. And we care about this a lot because the core of our property tax proposal is, of course, assistance to counties and cities and townships, but it's also that we're gonna see 90% of homeowners either get a bigger state refund than they get today, larger check, or start getting a check that they never got before. So we really want to find a way to make sure everybody knows in Minnesota what we're about. So I'm glad we have some agreement on growing participation, because I don't know, maybe House Research or your Senate Council could tell us. I think the participation rates is growing, and in fact it was this year the Department of Revenue or Department of Finance provided fastest growing parts of the budget, And one of the fastest growing parts is participation in the PTR. So that's good. It also maybe is a sign that property taxes are getting too burdensome, and so more and more people are finding out and applying because they can't pay their property taxes, and the refund is getting more important than ever. I don't know, but I think something the Senate and the House share is if we're going to have a program like this, we want everybody who qualifies to get it, so maybe we can find a way to work on what might ultimately work here.
Mr. Manson, do we? Mr. Volkman has some information on the participation rates. You don't offhand have that, the number of people who aren't participating?
I don't have that with me, but what's happening is I think we're getting more and more participation because more people are electronically filing. And if you electronically file, your practitioner, if you're in that income range that qualifies, will ask you those questions about a property tax refund. They have to buy the package from the developer that it has both pieces, the income tax and the property tax refund, but the majority of them have that. And then also if you paper file with your PTR, then you're sent the property tax instructions and forms as well. So I think as more people electronically file, they're getting asked those questions and prompted. And then if you file by yourself online, like TurboTax, they haven't offered that property tax refund component yet, but I believe they are going to next year. So I think, you know, just through the process, I think more and more people are being prompted and filing, so I think that's helping a lot.
Sure. I have used TurboTax, and they do.
Pardon me?
TurboTax, they ask that question, and it pops up. Sure. Yeah. Just for a matter of site information, I mean, I do it that
statements.
Way.
Yeah. I mean,
Chairman Bach, I found this, and this is from Ms. Alexandra Brode, who I believe is right here. And this is the part that was released that says it's the Minnesota Department of Finance fastest growing expenditure for 2007. And the property tax aid and credit, exactly, the homeowner property tax refund program. And it says spending for the regular homeowner's property tax refund program in 08-09 is expected to increase $63.4 million or 16.5% over expenditures for the program in 06-07. Goes down later and says what the program does, but says the main reason for the significant growth in the homeowner's property tax refund program is that residential homestead property taxes have been steadily increasing due to rising property values, decreases in homestead market value credit amounts as the average market value of home increases, local school referenda, and local spending decisions. So they're noticing already that property tax burdens are climbing and more people are filing. What I don't see on here is the actual participation rate. And my recollection, it was something in the high 60s to low 70s percent of who would actually qualify. And maybe we can get that later because we have a long way to go. If it says we've had 300,000 claimants in 06 going to 340,000 in 07, and that's not even bringing in all the people who qualify who could get it now, and then we'd like to expand who should get it. So I do think the Department of Finance or Revenue should try to get the conferees that information because it'll be a big part of trying to solve property tax relief this year.
Mr. Manson, the department has some ideas how we could increase participation or notify people. We'd probably like you to share that with us before we conclude here. Later this month.
I think it is the participation problem is bigger on the targeted refund. I think that's a lower participation than the regular homeowners.
Targeted was worse or better?
Targeted was worse. Almost no one applies for that.
Senator Bach, I was just going to mention that I think another thing that hasn't gotten mentioned is the fact of just timing, because when people fill out their income tax returns, they don't have their property tax statements, and so they have to remember to go back and do it or go back to the tax preparer or, you know, and so I think that's a big part of it is just, and then the other thing is people thinking of it as a low-income program and not as a middle-income. You know, it used to be thought of as a low income, and now the income is high enough that a lot of people that really should, that do qualify, are still thinking of it in this perception of the old kind of thought of that it's just a low income, and so they don't even look to see whether or not they've, that that they qualify for some refund. Moving on to Section 29, and this is one of the citizens' property tax suggestions, and this was to extend the time period for filing property tax refund claims by an additional year. And it's not the targeting, it's just the PTR. So, like, when you file, you have to file by August 15th, we'll say, of 07, and you have one additional year to file, which would be August of 08. This would give you an additional year. This would add 1 year onto that. There were people that sent in on the line, on the property tax comment line, that said, we didn't realize it until it was too late, and now, you know, we've lost out the property tax refund. And so this was to address that by adding the additional year.
Representative Marquardt, a lot of comments on this?
Mr. Chair, actually, the best testifier we had probably the entire division was this gentleman who spoke on this part. He really laid it out nicely on how, just quite frankly, there wasn't very good PR on any of that, and he had missed it, and he really then studied it and brought in a very detailed kind of process of how he missed it and all the ideas in which we could improve that. So this goes back 1 year, basically saying that if they didn't know it because kind of the lack of publicity by the state, that we now would be able to go back 1 year.
The next number of sections, it runs from sections 30 to 35, all address the senior citizen property tax deferral program. And rather than go through them section by section, the three changes that really get made in it are, first of all, the age requirement that now under this only one person has to be 65. The other one can be 62, because under current law they both have to be 65 when they apply. The second thing is it raises the household income from $60,000 to $75,000, so it will allow more people to be eligible for having some deferral. And then the third thing is it's in Section 35, and that is that the state will not charge interest on deferred property taxes, beginning with taxes payable in 08. Right now, the maximum is 5%. It follows what the same interest rate as the department charges on penalty for income and sales, which I think is 8%. It just went up to 8% this year. But the senior deferral program is at a maximum of 5 right now. But this drops it to a zero interest rate.
Representative Marquardt, why is that a good idea?
Mr. Chair, right now only about 130 people across the state use this program. And we thought, especially when we heard so many comments from seniors being forced out of their homes, that we wanted to try to make the program a little more attractive. You know, there's probably different ways in which we could have gone, but we thought these might be ways in which we could. I mean, 130 throughout the whole state is just really, really low, and we're hoping that this is an avenue that folks could use to stay in their home. So, I mean, there's probably different levers we could move around in this program, but we dealt with these.
Senator, the one provision on the top of page 19, the House Section 31 and the Senate Article 14, Section 50, that one was a Department of Revenue provision, and when you adopt all the department sections later on today or whenever, the list that that staff have prepared, we moved this section to there because it's a department provision, and this has to do with people that are purchasing, or it prohibits individuals who are owners of a life estate or purchasing the homestead under a contract for deed from participating in the senior deferral program, and the department wanted this provision put in. Would you want to? Section 36 is a sustainable forest incentive payment. This was Representative Dill's provision. And this raised the minimum amount to $5, of which will not make any difference anyway, in that right now $5.24, I believe, is the minimum using the formula for the different methods of computing the how the payment, because it's the greater of a couple property tax calculations or $1.50. So by raising this to $5, it will have no dollar effect. And I think the Senate is...
Mr. Chairman, Senate Section 35 just says that the payment cannot be less than $5 per acre.
Is it, Mr. Polson, how does that differ from the House language?
Actually, we have the two calculations. We have to look at it. Senator, it's just some technical, well, I think there is some substantive difference here because this language just says provided that the payment shall be no less, well, no, it's the same, it's just wording differences. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, sections 37 to 44 are a new House program that's, again, I think partly came out of the citizens' website. And rather than go through the individual provisions, I'll say that it's very much modeled after the senior deferral program. This is the seasonal recreational deferral program. And it's similar in that I'll say what the differences are. The main difference, I suppose, is that the senior deferral says that they'll defer taxes that exceed 3% of income. And because when you're dealing with a seasonal recreational property, there could be multiple owners. It didn't necessarily make sense to tie it to income per se because you're not necessarily talking about one person's income versus many. So instead, the concept used was to look at the base year values or the base year tax, so the tax amount in the year that they apply to get into the program, and then the amount that would be eligible for deferral is 50% of the amount of tax each year that's above the amount that it was in the base year. So there's no tie to income at all. It's simply a case of paying 50% of the tax over and above what the tax was in the base year. So that's one. That's the one, probably the biggest difference between the senior deferral and the seasonal deferral. A second difference is the notion of primary and secondary owners. And at the time you apply for or a property applies to be put in this program, they ask that all the owners that have been there 15 years. So there's a 15-year ownership requirement to go into the program. I think that's the same as the senior deferral, the 15-year. Yeah. But 15 years, and at the time that the applicant applies, they also list any other owners who have also been in for 15 years to be on that same application. So the primary owner, and then there are secondary owners, and that is really setting up a situation so that if the primary owner should essentially elect to sell out to the others, that they could pick up the program. Otherwise, if it's sold to a different entity, they would not be eligible to continue in the deferral, and the deferral would get collected. So there's this definitions of primary and secondary owners that are in the definition section. And then the other major difference between this and the senior deferral program is this uses an interest rate that's pegged at 2% above the interest rate on the senior deferral program. And partly since the senior deferral program, we are changing the interest rate on that in the bill anyway. We just wanted to make it be something above what the seniors were, but this doesn't. So this would be a 2% rate if the House provision would apply as zero on the seniors. Other provisions as far as penalties, et cetera, are all basically taken as much as possible from the senior deferral program. The program works as similarly as it can to that to the senior deferral program.
Representative Marquardt, this was another citizen provision. Do we know, are more than 130 people going to participate in this one?
Madam
Mr. Chair, don't know for sure. You know, the reason this was put in is, first of all, the tax plan of the House really focuses on homeowners and farmers. I mean, we actually, from 07 levels, cut taxes for homeowners and farmers. And so a lot of our dollars went in those areas. And yet everyone sees property tax relief. But one thing we heard time and time again were from people who had their lake property, and they said, you know, our taxes are going up so high, and we're hoping we can pass it on to our kids. So we thought this is a great way to do that. It's you know, a way in which if you're really having problems paying those taxes, you want to pass it down to your sons or daughters, this would be an avenue, this kind of an escape valve in which you would be able to do that. But, yeah, how many would use that, I don't know, but at least it leaves the option open now to keep this in the family if, in fact, they want to do that.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you. On the seasonal referral, how does it deal with the limiting that would be in effect on some of the seasonal rec properties now? You know, if this was to become law and they signed up, you know, and limiting goes away, which there's a chance, how does it deal with that value that's currently limited?
Limited market value?
Yeah. Limited market value, because there's a lot of value.
There's
a tax.
Mr. Chair, Representative Skoy, it's all linked to the net property tax. So, you know, if the limited market value goes off and your property taxes go up more, the lien or the deferral is 50% of the increase over the base amount where you start. So it actually comes down to your property taxes. So that would...
Mr. Chair, and so you've gotten a lot of seasonal rec value currently limited, and all of these folks would then have the opportunity to go into this deferral program, so that that property tax that they would pay if it wasn't limited would just continue to get shifted out onto other people in the community.
This one, the
state.
Who's going to pay the property tax?
Yeah, this would be the state that would come in and take over that 50% on the deferral, so there would not be a shift to any other properties. The state holds basically the lien or the loan or whatever it would be on that, and when it's transferred or they would pass away or whatever that case might be or want to get out of the program, that portion of deferral would have to be paid. But the state assumes that, so there's no shift in it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, is there any value limit to qualifying? I mean, could you have there's a $2 million, $5 million cabin, and $4 million of it's limited, and so then you would then be deferring all of that onto the state to pay that portion of the property tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Skoy, we talked about that, and we decided not to put a limit in there. So there's no market value limit on this.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we'll visit about this more. I just wasn't sure that would be the people that I would have thought we would have been targeting the property tax relief at.
So, Marquardt, you have to be a resident of the state of Minnesota to participate in this program?
That would be any property.
Representative Chesky, do you know how many of the state's cabins are owned by people who aren't residents of the state?
Senator Bach, well, I don't, but I should clarify. You know, first of all, you have to own the cabin for 15 years. And then these taxes get paid, and they get paid with interest. So, I mean, it works just like the current senior deferral, except for we have a 2% interest on the cabin. So over time, these taxes do get paid back to the state. The state's participation here is return plus interest.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chesky. Did I hear him say that it was 2% over 2%. The targeted, which was being moved to zero? So it's a 2% loan then? Is that what I
2% interest.
2% interest. And I just got handed a note. I think the tax incident study assumes 20% of the.
Yeah.
And Senator Bach, Chairman Bach, you know, remember, complicating this discussion, of course, is we've got limited market value going on for a while, and I think you're continuing the phase out, so that would have a factor in ultimately how a provision like this would work, as Senator Scoy has pointed out.
I want to clarify something. While the intent of this is to be able to pass it down to your children, they would then, when you transfer it to your children, they would have to pay the lien. So it doesn't this doesn't pass on. It stops at that point. But, I mean, if you wanted to keep it, they would have to then pick up the deferral at that point.
Sort of a nice gift.
Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't mean that. It's a way in which they can keep it until they transfer it.
And Senator Bach, I mean, I have to say, you know, I have a concern. I feel for folks who are trying to stay in their cabins. So they can pass it on. But it's difficult to explain then why their children shouldn't pay taxes if they want to keep that property. I mean, you know, I'm a kid of five kids sharing my folks' cabin, and boy, you know, I do think we have to think intergenerational equity here. You know, they're paying the snow plowing and bringing in the wood, and they're paying the mortgage, and they're paying the property taxes, and they're trying to keep it in there, and they're going to pass it down to five children, and we should assist if we want to keep that. And I think it's reasonable for people to, you know, we're trying to find a nice blend of being able to keep people to keep those cabins who are legitimately getting taxed out of keeping those cabins. But as that thing passes on.
Representative Lencheski, why do the kids wait to participate?
Yeah, I don't know.
The parents are gone.
Senator Bach, you and I agree. I agree.
Mom and dad or grandma and grandpa need help paying the taxes on the cabin. Why don't the kids help when they're alive? Why do they wait to pay the bill until they've passed on?
Senator Bach, you and I agree. And it's a little puzzling to me why people maybe of our generation aren't thinking that through on how they ought to help keeping those cabins in the family property. Maybe they ought to be stepping up. Although, you know, Senator Bach, I don't know what your parents are like, but my parents, you know, they won't, as much as their kids try to do everything, they keep just saying no. So maybe sometimes the kids have parents who won't take, you know, they don't want the assistance from the kids. But you're right. I mean, people start to feel like there's a birthright to these things without taxes, and we have to address it.
Anything else, Senator Smith?
Well, the only thing I would add is perhaps that eliminating the discrimination against the seasonal rec category by making them homestead residential would accomplish a lot of what we all just talked about.
Okay.
Senate's got a pretty good idea for cabin owners, Representative Lencheski. It'll help a lot.
Senator Bach, does the Senate want, and also the Senate wants cabin owners to pay the school levies? Is that strategy there?
The cabin owner lobby supports the Senate provision and are more than willing to pay excess levies on schools if they are relieved of the burden of the state general tax. And they may someday regret that decision, but as I understand their position, they think the Senate provision is a good one. Got a very nice letter from them that I saved.
Well, we should learn more. We should learn more about that because I think the state general levy has turned out to be a pretty good deal. I think the problem is rising market values, and I do think there should be caution in seasonal rec property when people think taxing it differently because today might stay the same way it is for all time. I don't know. I think it's sort of risky. I mean, I think part of the deal with having the cabins not pay the school levies was part of the argument that, you know, you can only send your kids to school in one school district. And so cabin owners aren't sending their kids to those schools. They're using the city services and they're using the county services, and they should be paying those local property taxes.
But I thought the state general levy was going to pick up any sort of contribution to education. So I'm actually kind of surprised that now they'd rather pay for taxes in two different school districts for the schools. So I do want to learn more, and maybe they can share their thoughts with us, because I'm a little confused about that provision.
Representative Marquardt.
I think in part of this discussion, Mr. Chair, on seasonal rec, we do have to go back to 2001, because at that time, when we took over the funding for education, the general ed levy primarily, homeowners and homesteads were getting about an 83% educational homestead credit, only paying about 17% of that general ed levy, where your seasonal rec was paying 100%. So when we took over the education funding, homeowners saw that 17% go, but seasonal rec saw that 100% go. So to kind of offset, they would have had a better deal than the homeowners. So to kind of offset that, part of it was the state general tax that was put on. So what you basically did is you took away the general ed levy and put a state general tax. And I don't know if it came to dollar to dollar, but what you'd be doing now is taking away the state general tax and not putting that general ed levy back on. So in the net impact from 2001 would be quite significant for seasonal rec. And I think we need to keep that in mind when you kind of move this around, because you're going to get things a little out of balance on at least what the intent. And I know you're not a fan of 2001, but part of that was to keep, otherwise they would have had a much better, I forget what their decrease would have been. It would have been quite significant, because they really benefited from that education going off. So now you still, when there's no general ed levy out there, and they just get the referendum levy and the debt service. So I think we better be careful just to see how this is going to wage on a homeowner, because I think we have to provide persons who's in their first home more benefits than someone who's in their second home in a cabin. And I have a cabin, but I think we've got to be careful that we're not providing them with better benefits.
So, Mark, one of my concerns is, let me give you an example. The Cook County School District in my district, in Cook County, which is the tip of Minnesota, sticking out into Lake Superior, about 91% of the land is owned by the government. So there's about 9% left to tax. And of the 9% that's left, over 60% of that tax capacity is cabins. And guess what? The Cook County School District has no excess levy, because they have nothing to tax. There's just nothing left. And how is a remote school district in the very corner of the state, bumping up against Isle Royal out there in Lake Superior? Schools don't, the students don't have an open enrollment opportunity to go down the road, go to another school, because maybe the curriculum is shrinking. How are we going to make sure that those kids, if we continue on the trend of excess levies to fund schools, what are we going to do in districts where they just have no tax capacity and their CI is cabins? And it's a real, and I thought about approaching this kind of from in a narrower way, to try and address some of these school districts that have a lot of cabin property and don't have much else to tax. And as we move down the road of allowing excess levies to fund schools, not all school districts can pass them. And I have the same situation at the Lake Superior School District, Two Harbors and Silver Bay. They have no excess levy either. And they have a lot of cabin property and just not much there left to tax. The government in Lake County owns 82 or 83% of the land is off the tax rolls. And then a big chunk of what's left is cabins. So I do think, and those, you know, those districts might be some of the more extremes in the state, but there certainly are other areas around the state where there's a lot of cabin property and not a lot else left to tax. Cass County is probably similar to that, I would think, in Senator Olson's district. I do think we have an issue in some school districts where that 2001 bill is creating some significant problems for school funding. Senator Squay.
Mr. Chair, I think that when you look at this, the seasonal rec currently does participate in part of the school levies. It's a voter-approved referendum that they do not participate in. And the voter-approved referendum is not enough to make up for the gain. I mean, there's significant property tax relief to those folks coming out of this statewide general tax, and it would be offset by the
maybe, Representative Chesky, maybe a little later on another day, we can maybe hear from the cabin lobby here at the Capitol and see kind of what they're thinking. But there is some risk in the Senate provision of putting them on the excess levy and taking them off the state general tax that someday they'll be back here saying, hey, get us off the excess levy, depending on how many excess levies pass.
Senator Bach, if, you know, I agree, you make a really good point for parts of the state, and I appreciate that you thought about trying to do it more narrow, because I do think you're talking about a statewide policy here for seasonal rec that could have, you know, a lot of adverse impacts that we haven't really thought of, and we did address the ag issue that's very similar to what you're saying. You know, we've got same situation happening around the state where farmers are going out and voting against those excess levies because their market values are going so high they can't, they support the schools, but they can't afford to have that levy pass. And I'm sure that's happening where you are, and then the cabins aren't participating. We did address it in our bill, in the K-12 bill, with an ag credit to deal with the school levies. I don't know how you're addressing your school levies, but it seems to me the core of the issue is the state meeting its responsibility to fund those levies and to equalize all those levies. And I think the two tax committees are left with trying to imagine or find up creative solutions for really a state funding problem for the levies. We shouldn't even have to go down that road. We shouldn't be offloading school funding on the levies in the first place, and we should be equalizing areas like yours that don't have the average net tax capacity that a city like mine does. You know, we had this discussion on the House floor, and we looked at a few cities, and my city, if you raise the tax rate 1%, we can generate $1,500 a head per resident. You're probably around $300. You know, that's not fair. And the state should be equalizing. But I think instead we're moving pieces around with ag lands and cabins to try to solve a bigger problem. And, you know, I'm not sure what we do, but I think we need to have further conversation before we try to fold everything together here, because I understand your problem, and as someone who visits your district, yeah, you've got a problem there. You don't have a lot of people to tax unless we tax the bears and the deer and everything else up
well,
there.
Well, it's interesting in that even equalization doesn't help.
If you don't fund it.
Because there's such a small amount of property, but it's still huge tax capacity because land is in such short supply in Cook County that small, modest homes are very expensive because there are very few. And that's the challenge, is it looks like there's a lot of tax capacity there, but it's in a small number of parcels. So if you go to try and raise excess levy for schools, it looks like there's tax capacity there to the point where there's not much equalization help, but the tax capacity is held in a small number of parcels. So there is a large impact on each taxpayer. There's only 5,000 people living in that county.
Senator,
we have some challenges.
That's why I think you'd like Representative Marquardt's 2% proposal, because in that very case, the state steps in based on your ability to pay and picks that up over 2% of your income so that you wouldn't have the burden falling on those folks, no matter what the parcel is and no matter what the tax capacity is. Just be based on the ability to pay. Now, if you're wealthy, yeah, the state's not going to step in on that piece of it. But
And if we're done with that part of it, there's a couple other things dealing with the seasonal rec that I want the House to think about. In part of our rural lands discussion, what's been going on is a fair amount of ag land has been bought for basically recreational land. The assessors are having a real hard time figuring out how to deal with that. Should it be seasonal rec? Should it be ag? You know, what are they going to put it in? So if you do away with the seasonal rec category and move to the rural land, that rural vacant lands class, it makes that an easy decision for them. And the other thing, Senator Bach, you've talked about up in some of your towns in that area where people are actually buying smaller house in town, using it kind of for a summer cabin. And how does the assessor deal with that? It's not on a lake, but it's not a, you know, full-time residence either. So, you know, there's things to think about with regard to seasonal rec that, you know, involve the cabins, but also other land classifications also as we go through this.
There is, Representative Chesky, there is a growing trend of people purchasing property off the lake that assessors are, it looks like a non-resident homestead, but it's, and we had the St. Louis County assessor in who, you know, St. Louis County is a huge county with a lot of lakes, and he expressed some great frustration that a lot of the property that's being classified is, they don't know how to classify it. A small house in Tower or Sedan or in Cook, which are all on the, just off the shores of Lake Vermilion that you would think is a residential homestead is being bought as a cabin. And the assessor is really struggling with, is it non-resident homestead, you know, like a rental type unit, or is it seasonal rec on a street in a small town? And the county, or the county assessor in St. Louis County expressed some great frustration with that growing trend and the problem it's creating for them. They don't know how to classify stuff. And I think that's going to grow as we see more and more second-tier development away from lakes. As lake property gets more and more expensive, more and more people are going to be priced off the lake, but still want to go to the, still want to spend time on the lake, so they'll buy a house in a small town, 5 acres out in the country somewhere, and just trailer their boat to the, to enjoy the lake for the day. And it is creating a real problem for the assessors, I think. You know, and add to that, more cabin owners now, in order to keep the cabin, may rent it out for part of the summer. I mean, and I personally know people on Lake Vermilion that rent their cabin for like a month, 1 month of summer, and it generates enough money to pay their property tax bill, and that's how they keep it in the family. Now, is that seasonal rec, or is that a rental unit?
Ooh. Yeah, that's the problem.
And that will, that's a growing trend. So, Representative Simpson.
And Senator Bach, to that point, I think there are, I think some of the associations are looking at that as a, as an unfair advantage for the rental properties, the resort properties that are paying the tax and paying it on the full rate, where now we're starting to see that secondary market come into play. So that adds another twist to it.
Right, I'm aware of that. This, but Representative Chesky, I'm glad that, you know, I live in cabin country, and I'm glad that that you have empathy for what families are dealing with and trying to keep the cabin in the family. It's a, it's a, it's a problem, and it's a, it's a way of life that may go away, and I don't know that we can save it. And maybe we can't. Maybe we can't save small resorts either. But hopefully, we can do something in the short term to try and make sure that cabins are able to be kept for, you know, just average Minnesotans. So they don't have to be, the only people that has them, you know, in the next generation are people that are wealthy. That would be a shame. We lost, because it is part of the culture of the state, to be able to, for just regular Minnesotans to be able to have a cabin at the lake. And I don't much, not sure that we can prevent the current trend that's happening, but I'm pleased that you understand it, because I hear it from people on the street all the time. And there's a strong attraction when those market values are going up and up and up and up, and the property tax burden is going up and up and up, and pretty soon you have to make a decision. You have to, and we know what's happening to college tuition. You know, and all of a sudden the kids are old enough, they have to go to college, and there's not enough money left in the family to do both. and it starts to look pretty attractive to dump the cabin for a large amount of money so that the kids can get out of college without debt. And once it's gone, it's permanently gone, because that family, unlikely they ever have another opportunity to buy back in. So, don't know that there's anything we can do, but appreciate your effort to try. Council?
Page 22, section 45 at the bottom is where we left off. This authorizes the town of Scambler to impose an aggregate gravel tax if one is not imposed by Otter Tail County. This is the same provision as was passed last year for Sylvan in Cass County. And if at some later time Otter Tail County imposes it, then the tax would be repealed on the effective date of the county tax.
Mr. Chairman, the same provision is in Section 15 of the Senate Minerals article.
Mr. Paulson, I thought I remembered the Senate limited the uses of the aggregate tax some, so it's not exactly the same. And Council?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, there was a provision that was added in committee to the Senate provision to say that the proceeds of the tax have to be used for the purposes described in Subdivision 7, which is the general law provision, says you have to use it for road and bridge and mine land reclamation. There had been some testimony that the Scambler people thought they might be using it for property tax relief.
Oh, okay.
So the intention was to limit it to what I assume was the intention.
Senator Chesky, I think if you had heard the testimony in the Senate, you probably would have limited it a little bit. Senator Larson?
I remember that, Mr. Chair, very well.
The next section, 46, on hardship assessment deferral. This just extends the option to defer certain assessments to members of the National Guard and Military Reserve that are ordered into active service. Currently, counties and cities and towns, and this is at their discretion, can defer payment of special assessments for a homestead for seniors and disabled that they determine cause a hardship, and this just extends it to National Guard and Reserve members. This was Representative Ruth's bill. The next provision was Representative Tori Westrom's bill. This extends the Economic Development Property Tax Abatement Authority to delinquent taxes, penalties, and interest. So it allows political subdivisions to include those amounts in any property tax abatement they grant. And this, again, is it's optional. It's just within his county, they had wanted to do this, and the law was pretty specific that it was only for current, not for delinquent. And so this just gives that authority. But if delinquent taxes are abated, then the years for which they're abated are included in the duration limits. For that. And like this, do you want to talk? Or I guess the fiscal disparities, why don't we skip 48 through 51 and we can talk about that in when, oh, I'm sorry, 48, 49, and 50 when we get to section 59, the repealer, and Mr. Hines can talk about that. Section 51 is a provision of Representative Davenport's, and this just amends a special law for the city of Minneapolis that relates to street maintenance and lighting to allow the city to pay from city general revenue part or all the construction and operation costs, as well as maintenance of street and lighting. And there's also a provision in the repealer that repeals a law that will also come later on.
Representative Daphne, does this have something with the special taxing districts, or what?
Mr. Chair, this is an attempt to solve a mystery in Minneapolis. For reasons that no one is able to identify, in 1973, the legislature passed a law prohibiting Minneapolis from assessing for street and light maintenance like, I think it's 20-some communities just in the metro area do. What that means is street and light maintenance competes for general fund dollars against public safety and other needs, and it makes it harder then for the city to, given the volatility in the general fund, to planfully look forward on street and light maintenance. This would just allow us to assess for it like other folks do. does not have to do with the other provision that you referenced.
The next section, 52, is this exchange of the tax forfeited land, the private sale in Itasca County, and that's been acquired through the tax forfeited land, or it exempts the lands in Itasca County that have been acquired through this exchange from that land assurance fee. The proposed land sale is about $6 million, and that assurance fee is 3%, so this is about $180,000 cost. But tax-forfeited land that's subject to that assurance fee at the time of sale, it's collected by the county auditor and sent to the state and deposited in general fund. And I think you have that in a different, you have that in a different bill.
Mr. Chairman, that provision is in Senate File 1312, which is apparently on general orders, at least at the time that we wrote this.
That was Representative Solberg's bill in the House. Do you want to do the students?
Mr. Chairman, Section 53 of the House bill is a study. It requires the Commissioner of Revenue to do a study of the Fiscal Disparities Program and make a report to the House and Senate tax committees by February 1st of 08. The bill outlines the goals of the program and asks that the study assess how the program is meeting those goals. And there's an appropriation for this study later in the in one of the later articles.
Section 54 requires the Commissioner of Revenue in consultation with county officials to undertake to improve the public awareness and participation in the property tax refund programs. And this is the other provision I was referencing when we were talking about putting information on the income tax booklets. It's the idea of it here to make sure that the public are aware of all the various property tax refund programs, and it lists options here that the commissioner must consider, but not limited to direct mailings, an insert in the statements, more prominent and direct references to the programs, notifications on the property tax statement envelopes or folders, or public service announcements, or just information and handouts at the TNT hearings. And these were all ideas that came about through the discussion with Representative Anderson and Loeffler, in addition to discussions that went on in the Property Tax Division. The next one is Truth in Taxation Program Costs and Participation Study. This requires the commissioner to prepare a study of the costs of TNT and the level of taxpayer participation, the cost of preparing and mailing the notices and the advertisements, and any costs associated with the hearings need to be included, and recommendations need to be made by January 15th, 2008 to the House and Senate tax chairs as to the cost of these programs, of this of the TNT program.
But Representative Markert, what are interesting idea. What are we trying to get at?
Well, Mr. Chair, initially Representative Haas came in and wanted just to look at what are the costs, the city costs and county costs for truth and taxation. Kind of, I think what the premise is that very few people show up for these truth and taxation meetings, and it is very costly. My point, and that's why you kind of have a second part to this, is I think cities and counties could do a lot more than they do to try to get people to the meetings. And, for example, when a school district is trying to go out and sell a bond issue, they go out and they meet with the Rotary Club and the Lions Club, and they go to church groups, and they go out to sell their program. And I think there needs to be more on the behalf of local units of government to try to get more people. It's easy to not make a lot of effort to get people involved, and then you say, geez, here, this thing is failing, no one comes out. Now, I know that only so many are probably going to come out, but I'd like to look at ways in which maybe some creative ways to get people involved, maybe over the internet even, or interactive television. And I know some cities right now do a pretty good job of having budget workshops and stuff like that. So there's really two parts. What's the cost? But also the second part is to see how you can get people involved. Personally, I think truth and taxation is the right way to go. It increases accountability and gives people a say and a notice and so forth. It hasn't been working, quite frankly. People don't show up, and it seems to be a waste of time and money. But I'm thinking maybe there's some ways we can go out and make it worthwhile. So that's what this study would
do. Do you think cities and counties want more participation?
Mr. Chair, I won't say for sure, but I would go back to what school boards do when they want to sell a bond issue. They want people to be informed, you know, and a lot of times when a bond issue fails, it's people weren't informed, you know, whether or not that's true or not. But they want to get people informed on things, and I do think cities and counties could do a better job of
it. Clarence Coyle, you're a county commissioner. Counties want more people to participate?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was thinking back to my days on the county board, and I attend these meetings and county commissioner. I also attended the school district truth and taxation. You know, I thought some of the folks came for the cookies and coffee. Sure, they were. They'd see them at all of them. They'd have cookies and coffee and visit.
That's good people.
Well, I don't know. That's reason to bring. The free food always tends to bring people out.
Senator Black.
Representative Chesky.
Are you going to have Senator Skoy bring cookies and coffee tomorrow?
We have cups now. We could bring
cups. We're ready. We should do that.
Representative Chesky, my legislative assistant brought homemade chocolate chip cookies this morning made from scratch.
Ooh.
They were good.
Wow.
Rather have that.
She'll never do that again.
Yeah, no. Senator Bach, seriously though, the truth and taxation issue. You know, I admit I'm a big fan of it, and I know often those who don't like it, and there's some cities and counties who don't like it, and some who do, and legislators like it, and some who don't, will say, well, they're poorly attended, so let's not have them. You know, I've often thought that the fact that they have to have them changes their behavior, because they don't know if one person's coming or 100. It's sort of the same thing with the advent of the open meeting law or televised meetings, you know. Without an accountability check, you don't know what would happen. And I think sometimes citizens say, well, you know, I don't know that I want to go to that thing because it's competing with my kid's softball game or the wrestling match or, you know, the hockey game or doing nothing, laying on the couch. But I could if I wanted to. And I could go see what they're doing, and I could have them explain to me why they're doing what they're doing. So, you know, I don't know if the author of this bill, which I think was Representative Haas,
right. Yeah.
is a fan of it or not, honestly. You know, I think people are divided on whether the TNT is doing anything or not. I actually think it's a good idea, and I don't know what the study would show, but I think there's an argument for having a look at these issues because I think, you know, if you take this away, which often folks are moving toward, at least in the House. There's bills every year for people to just get rid of it. Then what? Then what's the accountability? You know, I like the TNT. When I was on the city council, I always thought it was a great thing. I mean, it forced the city council to think about how it was going to be received by the public when they unveiled their budget, whether anyone came or not. It was still in the context of public scrutiny, so.
Representative Chesky, under that spirit, I agree with you. But when in the days following the Truth and Taxation meeting, I get phone calls and they say, they told us to call you, that it's your fault.
Sometimes it is our fault, though, Senator Bach.
Senator Bach.
Not you and I.
Representative Simpson?
I think I have a lot of the same issues with this as you probably do. A past mayor seeing experience of the people showing up, but for Senator Skoy, besides the coffee and cookies, did they have any qualms about anything other than their valuation going up?
You're pretty close to Akron, Representative Simpson.
How much does it cost? study, do we know?
Got a number.
I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea, but it depends on how many studies we're going to do, and there's a cumulative impact of all these studies when it starts to become real money.
Senator Bach, we put money on our studies. I know in the past sometimes the House or the Senate conferees have asked for studies without money, and we actually paid for them on a spreadsheet. So.
No, I didn't think so.
We didn't think it was fair to ask anybody, department or anyone else, to study without an appropriation, so we do have a price on them all.
No cost.
Mr. Manson, you want us to put money in for the studies?
There's no appropriation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment on studies in general, especially in this property tax area, which is a very specialized area of tax administration. And our resources, the knowledge and experts in this area are very scarce. And over the last, I believe, last couple of years, we've done about six different assessment studies. I think they're very well received and a good product, but it does take a lot of resources. And, you know, as the session ends up here, we spend a couple, 3 months trying to implement all the changes, and that takes a lot of staff time. So we're really stretched in this area of our expertise. So, if we can limit the number of studies, especially in this area, or we like the fiscal disparity study, we really think we need an outside consultant for that one. Specifically to this truth in the taxation study, if we could just put together a report, do some surveying rather than recommendations, which gets a lot more complicated, that would help in this one. But just really, this is an area that's very specialized. We don't have a lot of employees that really know the nuts and bolts, and so it's a lot of demands on a small group of people.
Thank you. I think that's helpful. Representative Cheska, I think we do need to be a little careful when we start moving with all kinds of studies that we don't burden the department in one specific area of their expertise so that they can't get anything else done. I mean, regardless of whether we appropriate the money or not, they still physically have to have the people on staff to be able to do it. So maybe we'll, before we move a bill, I'll take a look at how many studies we have and see if they have the manpower to do them all. And maybe we need to tweak them a little, some of the hours required so that they can perform them on time or change some of the dates we want their reports back or something so that they can actually get the job done.
And Senator Bach, I would just add, I don't know that all the studies can be done by the department. I think probably the fiscal disparity study in particular would be vended out. That's a pretty complicated one, and I don't know that that's something that they would want to do. And I don't know that we would want them to do it, but maybe they can make some recommendations to us on some of these concepts. I do think the sales tax study, which we haven't gotten to yet, you're going to like that one because that's going to be, Senate's going to be happy to see that provision.
Mr. Chairman, the suggestion you made is one that a number of years ago, and was quite involved with K-12 finance, Senate came in with a number of studies. We came in with a number, and it just became overwhelming. And so what we agreed to do, we did exactly what you described. We prioritized some of them and changed some of the timelines.
So maybe before we had to start adopting studies, we should get a list of how many we really have, and so that we want a good product.
56 is the temporary suspension of the apportionment of tax in Lake County, and it provides that upon approval. Suspend the apportionment of proceeds from the tax forfeited lands until Lake County has been reimbursed for the purchase of that was made in 2006 for 6,085 acres of forest land named the Claire A. Nelson Memorial Forest. And the amount is $2.2 million plus interest. And it also provides that any revenue derived from 6,085 acres of forest land is subject to the above apportionment. In your DNR omnibus land acquisition. The next provision, 57, Lakeview Cemetery Association. This is a bill that
Ann Sells.
Ann, what?
Amzell.
That's
a hard one.
Yes. There's an existing law for the Lakeview Cemetery Association that has two or three of these cities and towns in it. And what they wanted to do is repeal that law, and you'll see it back in Section 59, and create a different authorization that allows several of these. You can see the list of cities and towns, Coleraine, Bovee, Tackinac, Marble, and so on, to form the Cemetery Association, and it allows additions and withdrawals into it, and to be able to levy a tax levy and have a uniform tax rate, because right now there's a dollar amount that each of the three, I think, associations are, three of them,
what's yours?
No. And this way, if you get uniform tax rate, regardless of how large all the cities or towns are, they can levy up to $200,000 a year. And this would be in addition to any other taxes, so it's outside of any other calculations or rates or capital limits. And it's also in addition to anything that they're currently levying for their cemetery purposes, because I guess this is a cemetery that all of these cities and towns use, kind of an area cemetery. In addition to that, some of the cities and towns do have small ones within their own city and town. So the next section, 58, is permitting Itasca County Auditor to lease tax forfeited land to Minnesota Steel for a period of 20 years for tailings basin and buffer area, and the lease is renewable. And I see that's on your general order. And then the repealer, I'll let paragraph B and C on page 27, we've already talked about.
Mr. Chairman, paragraph A of section 59 is the repealer of the provision in law that requires the city of Bloomington to make additional payments to the fiscal disparities pool from beginning in payable 2009 through 2018. And these repayments are required because of the complex financial arrangement that was made in doing the road improvements in the Mall of America site back in the mid-90s. Road work that would have been done on the state schedule 10 years later was accelerated to being done earlier, with the idea that the bonds would be sold and the principal would be paid by the state at the time the state normally would have done the improvements. And the interest was paid by the fiscal disparities pool over the 10-year period, and then this was to regard as a loan. These interest payments, which Bloomington was to pay back to the pool, beginning originally in 2000, and that has now been delayed twice, so that's now scheduled to start in 2009. That's about $5 million per year payments over the 10-year period.
Mr. Chairman, Senate local development articles, section 19 and 20, have provisions related to fiscal disparities in the city of Bloomington. Section 19 has the Hennepin County Auditor calculate and certify the amount of the area-wide levy that's generated by Phase 2 of the Mall America project as an additional distribution to the city of Bloomington from the fiscal disparities pool. And then section 20 requires the amount of that levy to be added to the area-wide levy.
Does anybody remember how much money that was?
$5 million a year, I would guess.
Six point five.
How much? 6.5 per year?
Park, 6.5.
Representative Chesky, could you have got that passed in the House?
Your?
Our provision.
I'm trying to understand this in the box. Requires the Hennepin County auditors to calculate and certify the CI area-wide levy as an additional distribution. So the FD payment that's given to the city of Bloomington, is that?
Correct. The money that would flow
going
into the
forward
pool.
Forward or going backward?
Going forward.
Forward.
Going forward, the money that would flow into the pool by the phase two expansion is captured and given to the city of Bloomington.
So I'm trying to understand this. So if, Senator Bach, I think you know that the local taxpayers, not the state, contrary to what most people walking around here think, and I'm sure your tax committee knows this and the House does, but for many legislators and much of the public, people think the state built the mall, and I know you know that the local taxpayers threw in $108 million for the first one, not the state. And if I understand your provision right, if the local taxpayers pay for the phase two as well, then the FD contribution that the mall should make to the whole metro will instead go to going forward for Bloomington, but nothing going backward on previous contributions for the first phase of the mall? Just trying to understand it.
I think what we're trying to do is capture some money, maybe help the mall move forward with an expansion. And under this provision, the entire metropolitan area, not just the city of Bloomington,
yes,
would make a contribution towards paying off the bonds on whatever public infrastructure had to be built for phase two. Senator Larson, did I phrase that accurately?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lincheski, this provision would not just remit the dollars to the city of Bloomington, but as a part of this, the city of Bloomington has expressed a desire to then turn those dollars into the project as a part of a public contribution to build the second phase of the mall.
So basically the mall phase two won't have to pay their fiscal disparities contribution like every other commercial industrial property in the metro. Instead, they'll get to pay it to themselves. Is that the structure, Mr. Michael?
Certify that amount. Add it to the area wide so it's spread across the entire all CI property in the metro area. And the revenue comes back. So all the participants in the pool get the same money they otherwise would, but the CI property in the metro area will pay a slightly higher rate. That seems to be.
Okay, so Senator Bach, trying to understand this, and is there any requirement that the city of Bloomington actually has to give that to the taxpayers of Bloomington who've been shelling out money to the Mall of America for years and years and years, or is that just for the city to spend on something else?
Representative Lincheski, I'm trying to be empathetic to the fact that the citizens of Bloomington really stepped up to the plate and financed phase one. And I think a whole lot of other people benefited from the willingness on the part of the residents of Bloomington to make that local contribution to phase one. And I think it's not unreasonable for other people in the metropolitan area that visit the mall frequently to help the residents of Bloomington participate if phase two is going to happen, so that the entire burden doesn't fall on just the residents of Bloomington. Senator Larson?
Mr. Chair, that's correct that the Senate provision is intended to, given the request that the city of Bloomington has brought forward, is intended to not have, to the degree possible, Bloomington property taxpayers funding the second phase to the same degree or percentage that the first phase was accomplished. However, there is also a provision here as it relates to tax increment that, of course, was a part of the first phase discussion that the city is obligated under. There's some additional language in here as it relates to that. But I think Senator Bach is, in this bill, is attempting to not have it fall all on the property taxpayers or homeowners in the city of Bloomington.
So, Senator Bach, just understand this a little better, and I appreciate that.
Pretty good work.
Okay. And I know Senator Larson is informing you of the needs of Bloomington all the time. And I have to tell you, though, you know, if you buy the argument that, you know, the mall is the big generator of taxes for everybody, and they pay state sales taxes, and they pay state income taxes, and they pay the state general levy, and they pay into the fiscal disparities pool, you know, but so does every other business. And in general, we don't buy businesses another addition because they pay their taxes. But if you think that's a good enough incentive because you actually pay your taxes, who's getting all those taxes? The state. So I see this as a spreading beyond local to the metro, but why not the whole state? I mean, these state revenues are pouring into the state general fund, and you know Senator Bach, I'm being a little rhetorical here, but Senator Marty, who hasn't said much so far since we started meeting, I think is someone who that he and I actually feel very similar about corporate subsidies in general and tax increment financing, and really that's just an offloading of tax burden to local property taxpayers to pay businesses taxes. And so while I understand that there are things that people would like to achieve, I mean, you know, I am one who feels that the best use of taxpayers' money as it relates to business is to keep business tax rates as low as you can. I mean, we don't have CI tax increases in our bill. We'll get to that later. And to treat all businesses equally. Let them compete, and if we're going to buy them stuff, let's buy stuff that they all use, like higher ed or K-12 or roads. I mean, I would single out a couple to get huge tax relief at the expense of everyone else. I mean, I don't know how all those other CI properties in the metro are going to feel about these guys getting a break. I mean, maybe the way they look at it is, you know, hey, I just pay into the fiscal disparities pool no matter what, and I don't care how it moves around in the pot. I have to pay anyhow. So I do appreciate the spreading a little further, but, you know, the recipient of these taxes, if you buy that people who pay taxes should therefore get tax breaks, is the state. It is the state. They're paying state sales tax, state income tax, state property tax. So I see this as a step in the right direction. But I don't know. I mean, I guess the majority of folks in the metro are actually beneficiaries of fiscal disparities. The city I represent isn't, so they might want to weigh in, too, about how they feel about fiscal disparities as it relates to this tax-based sharing program that we've got in the state of Minnesota, which no other state has. I mean, only Minnesota has fiscal disparities, and it's sort of like LGA, too. It's equalization on top of equalization, but, you know, I appreciate that you've listened to Bloomington and Senator Larson, and, you know, that you do understand that the state did not build the first phase. And I guess I when I read the mall's original bill, they were asking the state to chip in, and I don't think you have a state contribution in your bill, do you? Is that accurate?
Correct. We do not.
Well, we'll keep talking.
And, I mean, I think phase two of the mall is an important economic development project, and it puts a lot of people to work, about 15 million man hours of construction. That is a big project. But I don't think when we're looking at public participation in the infrastructure that it should have to compete with money for K-12 or for higher ed or for clean water. I don't think economic development is as high a priority. And so we were just looking for some way to provide some public infrastructure and not use money that would have taken away from other spending priorities, higher spending priorities. So we don't know. We think this gets us partway there. We don't think probably doesn't do the whole job. I actually don't know if the city of Bloomington supports this provision. Haven't heard from them on that.
Senator Bach, I don't know either, and others have more to say. I guess, were you or was your committee convinced that the mall needed public money to continue to grow in Minnesota? I mean, so we heard their bill, and, you know, I had a hard time finding any compelling reason why, not just this company, you know, but any company needed a public subsidy to do business in Minnesota. We do have a TIF district for Thompson West. We actually looked at all the TIF proposals and thought of all the TIF proposals out there, that wasn't so bad compared to many. Although we certainly don't have many TIF districts in our bill, but we didn't do any corporate subsidies. We weren't trying to single out that the mall was a no. We just didn't do any. And I guess, were people compelled? I actually listened to part of the tape when you had that hearing, and I went back and watched it, and I heard senators say that they wish the Mall of America was in their district. And I thought, well, they should just chip in $295 million in local taxpayers' money, and they'd probably get it. And that's Bloomington's contribution. It's $108 million plus $50 million in the repayment piece, and if this goes forward, it's another $138 for a net $295 million from local taxpayers. So, you know, I did hear some senators, not you, say that they would just love to have the mall in their city, and I, you know, it seemed that to me it was easy to argue that we ought to do it if they didn't have to pay for it. So I was hoping that those who felt they needed it so badly would be willing to raise state taxes to pay for it, but that didn't come out of the hearing, at least that I was listening to. So, you know, Senator Bach, in all seriously, I know you do a great job in your line of work, and you want to put people to work, and those are real jobs. They're not temporary jobs. They're meaningful jobs in construction, and I appreciate that. I really do. And labor wants this, and I understand that. I also know that there's a mismatch between who's paying and who's benefiting, as there has been in the past project. And those of us who represent the city of Bloomington have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, if Senator Skoy gives you $100 and you pay $100 to me, well, he still didn't get paid back. So, you know, Bloomington has not been a net beneficiary of this project yet. We're still paying on it. We've got a fiscal disparities repayment coming. And it, after all these taxes that flow through the system in amusement and hotel and motel and liquor and lodging and all these things going on, Bloomington's netting out $1 million a year. $1 million a year. Well, you know, we've put in 108, so we're going to have to live to be 108 years old to break even. And now we're being asked to put in more. So it gets complicated locally, and I hope you can respect my view as I respect your view as it relates to labor. And I honestly do. I question how much of that would happen anyhow. You know, what substitution effect would happen in the economy with those folks being put to work on other projects with or without subsidy. So, you know, I know you and I will continue to talk about this and others have thoughts, but I want you to hear that it's awkward since I represent the city who wants this. And I have, the city council members are my friends. They know I disagree with them on this. And the people of Bloomington, there are some who are for it and some who are against. I just, you know, I have this problem when I know too much. Just, I did know all the details of the financing of phase one and phase two and the nuance of every bit of this. I could maybe be for it, but I do know the facts as it relates to this, and it's not a good deal, and it's very difficult to argue that this is the kind of economic development we do with public money if we were going to do economic development. So,
Sir Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lincheski, I think to further explain, I think what the Senate proposal does is, given the passionate request from the city of Bloomington for tools, if you will, to try to further develop that property, the Senate bill includes a number of those tools for consideration. And as you know from a lot of discussions that I've been involved in with the city that both of you and I represent, I have different feelings about each of the different provisions. Some I like better than others. In fact, I think that Mr. Chair would tell you that during the discussion, I offered a provision, in fact, on tax increment financing portion that's in here as it relates to the extension to actually let the voters of Bloomington weigh in on whether or not they wanted to
in fact, pay that additional tax, or if the city of Bloomington should look in a different direction. I think it's fair to say that in the provisions that are in the Senate bill, like I said, it provides tools that the city will have to make some decisions about, because I think if you levied all the taxes that are, if you used all the tools at their maximum in the Senate bill, it would raise more than what the city believes it needs to do its maximum public subsidy. And so it's in some ways options, I think, that are in the Senate bill for people to consider. And like I said, I offered an opportunity for our committee to kind of, you know, ask Bloomington residents if they want to pay the TIF part. I think that failed on a narrow vote, and this is the Senate position, and I think that we'll probably get a lot more conversation. But I think that we had a lot of conversation in the Senate about it, and a lot of a full hearing, and the committee members on the Senate side got to hear probably more than they even cared to about my position on. But I feel very passionately about some of these provisions in terms of whether or not what level of participation local taxpayers have provided to this point and what they ought to provide into the future. And so, but I think that's the basis for our ongoing discussion in this conference committee.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can hardly believe I'm saying anything on this, but you did talk about the meeting that the Senate had, and what I did learn, I mean, it was interesting, is that it isn't just the money that was there that drove this in Bloomington. It's the airport and the freeways. And I know the airport is controversial. I said through transportation hearings. But, you know, this was a kind of an ideal location because people can fly in and use it. So it really wasn't much of an option for other communities. It's more than just money. And I hope that it can move forward in some mechanism. But, you have it in your district, work the detail out.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, since everybody else is commenting on this, I want to say that I think the Mall of America is time to snooker the people of Minnesota. I remember when they were here at the legislature demanding we keep the airport where it was because they really needed it nearby because it was good for business. At the same time, the same lobbying firms representing the same company goes to the Airports Commission and tells them, if you don't transfer this property east of the mall to the property north of the mall and give us TIF on it, this property they paid $1 for. And all of that because of height restrictions from the new runway because they were staying put. They went and argued both sides that by you can't take the airport away from them because they needed it there for business. And then saying, because you're keeping the airport here, you guys got to subsidize our development further. I mean, they walked all over us, and I still think that this is the most developable piece of property in the upper Midwest, and we have to subsidize it, and if we're going to subsidize businesses, I can at least understand the arguments for Thompson West because, you know, if it's not here, it's going to be in some other state. But retail, I mean, my city's always trying to subsidize Rosedale because they need to compete with the mall. In downtowns, we have to subsidize all the retail, and Sir Bach, I understand the need for good construction jobs, but I think the public responsibility is what Representative Lanchesky said. I mean, the infrastructure we should be building for business should be the schools and the roads and the transits, all the public infrastructure that we're responsible for instead of retail businesses. I think we're being taken on this, but I felt that way for a long time. I think we should have a flat-out policy, no subsidies for retail, period, anywhere in the state for any reason.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to weigh in as one of those, as representing one of those communities that definitely benefits from fiscal disparities. I represent Anoka County, and we do benefit from fiscal disparities, and I think if we all recall, the reason that it exists is because of an inequity of commercial and industrial tax base within our communities. And if we start subsidizing Mall of America with fiscal disparities money, I think that takes away that equalizing factor. Just like we talked about with cabins up in your school districts, the whole equalizing the equalizing component is just so important that we continue to do that in the state, and I think that just diminishes that that policy.
Representative Dietrich, what do you think about the House provision of allowing the city of Bloomington not to pay back their loan, $48.5 million?
Well, I don't know that I think that it's not paying back. I think that, at least the way that I see this, is I think that it is something that that they have put forward. They've made that investment, and I think that they should be able to, we should ought to be able to work with them.
Well, Mr. Chair, just so I understand it, I thought that was a loan. I thought they had an original agreement that was signed a number of years ago, and that was a loan. Is it or isn't it? Just so I'm clear on that.
Rev. Lanchesky, is it a loan?
I'd love to explain this provision to you, Senator Skoy. Long ago and far away, when I was in college, before that, you know, Mr. Michael should explain this, actually, because he's been here. He's been here since the beginning. He was here when this was a twinkle in Governor Perpich's eye. He's been here. And I'll tell you what I know, though. Before that, before the mall, there was some question as to what was going to happen to the old stadium. And so as MnDOT was trekking through to build Highway 77, they got to the area where it was, hey, what's going to happen with this stadium? And they stopped the scheduled road improvements. The MnDOT road improvements were coming online now for Cedar Avenue, Highway 77. And because it was unclear what was going to happen there, MnDOT said, we owe the money to you guys to fund this, but we're not going to do it right now. And instead, they went up to the site, and they went past the site, and they built the Cedar Bridge. Well, when time passed and something was ready to develop there, the city came back to MnDOT and said, hello, you know, you were supposed to pay for those roads over there. We're ready. Start building. And MnDOT at that time said, well, we don't have the money now. We all know how that works in our districts, where money appears and disappears through MnDOT. So the city of Bloomington and the mall, as I understand it now, this is now I'm up to college, decided that we'll do MnDOT a favor. We will build not roads for the mall, state scheduled roads that were scheduled and on the books before the mall was conceived of. We will front you the money out of the fiscal disparities pool, which MnDOT was supposed to pay for from the get-go. Instead, the city said, wrongly, in my estimation, former folks in charge said, rather than making the mall pay the interest on it, or saying, better yet, the state should just pay it, because this was the state's obligation. It was not the obligation of the city. It was not the obligation of the developer. Instead, the city and the developer got together and said, we'll do MnDOT a favor. We'll loan you the money in the fiscal disparities pool. We'll pay it back, which was done very quickly, and then we'll pay interest on it. I don't think the former city council should have made that decision. That was before my time. But this was MnDOT's scheduled road improvements, not caused by the Mall of America. Contrary to what people might think, we can show you all the documentation. And so since that time, the loan was paid back immediately. It's just the interest we're talking about, and that's been put off a couple of times as people have pondered whether that was a good policy or not, to have cities really build MnDOT roads for them. But for this fiscal disparities pool that the mall was going to put money into, there wouldn't have even been a resource to bail the state out. This is sort of like Crosstown, where we had to go ask private developers to build the Crosstown, and we found out they weren't going to do that. Same kind of thing was happening back then. So now there is that repayment component. I guess, you know, I've got the runs actually by the Metro as to if Bloomington has forgiven the fiscal disparity loan payment, you know, what it would cost. And, I mean, I think the highest place it costs is about $4 a head in the city of St. Paul. And the whole county of Anoka, it's $2. And what has the fiscal disparities pool received from that building from that time? $85 million. So all the recipients of those payments have received $85 million. You know, the city of Bloomington is the largest contributor to fiscal disparities and does not receive from it, as it should. It's a large CI property, high net tax capacity community. But the beneficiaries of that mall, and this is sort of, again, the irony of the twist, you know, the city of Bloomington paying in, who who's the beneficiary, again, in the fiscal disparities repayment? Everybody not in Bloomington. So we've been trucking along all these years where all these cities are recipients of improved fiscal disparities due to this, while the city is on the hook for MnDOT interest. And so I guess, you know, I think it's legitimate to say that this is a non, you know, non, for folks who don't represent Metro, you don't care. But if you represent the Metro, you have to say, well, is it legitimate that, you know, maybe Dakota County loses $3 a head, even though they've been a recipient from that one building of $85 million or not? I don't know. But I do think that it was not a good idea for the residents of Bloomington to have to pay interest to loan MnDOT money to build the highways they were always supposed to. Contrary to some of the things we now hear, we have developers out in the Metro who want to build big projects and say, build the roads for us. That's not what happened here. These roads were scheduled improvements. I don't know why. Back when I was in college, some folks thought it was a good idea to have Bloomington pay the interest on that, but I think the beneficiaries of that, who's paying the taxes there, have spread wide and far across the Metro, and Bloomington residents have not received it. This is another $50 million price tag to the people of Bloomington to just keep paying for phase one. I mean, I think people need to understand that we in Bloomington aren't even done paying for phase one, and we're being asked to pay for phase two. Without this repayment provision disappearing, it's another $50 million bucks. Another $50 million bucks. You know, I would argue the mall probably should have paid it. I don't know. I wasn't there. I have read some of the articles that Senator Marty was talking about, though, about this whole the TIF swap and, you know, all the history of what's been going on around this, and it's confusing. But Mr. Michael is a great resource for anybody, not, you know, bipartisanly, who wants to understand what happened when, because he's one of the few people who's really been here since the get-go.
Mr. Michael, anything to add? Ms. Zahn?
Why is he saying no?
Right. Representative Carlson.
I have a question about the Senate provision. Has anybody calculated then what the impact would be on the in fiscal disparity is area, or I'll ask Hennepin County in particular, because on the north end we are recipients of fiscal disparities in the center, Crystal, Golden, Robbinsdale area.
On a per capita basis, I'm not aware of any numbers.
Has anybody done anything with it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I don't think we have a run that shows a projection, although Representative Lincheski gave, you know, pretty good description of what the mall's first phase provided to the pool. And I think, you know, some of the assumption is that beyond the time that those payments are captured, the pool will again be the beneficiary of a larger Mall of America. Now, that will take some time, but that will essentially be the spread-out investment rather than the direct investment from city taxpayers. Not to my knowledge, I have not seen a run per capita on the fiscal disparities communities that are gainers. I think we have a general idea of what the capture amount is, and Ms. Zoff, I don't know. I thought it was about 6.5, but do you know what we were calculating as it related to that?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Hines has some information on this because he's worked on forgiveness part with me over the years, but I have not requested anything on the phase two, but I would imagine other legislators have. So he has done some modeling. I have not seen it on phase two.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I don't have data on that, but it was kind of a subtle point that Mr. Michael mentioned when he went through this mechanism in the Senate bill, that the jurisdictions that receive money from the fiscal disparities pool will not be out any money because of this mechanism. It was designed in such a way that the subsidy that's coming through, or the is by tacking on an added charge to the CI properties metro-wide to make sure that the communities that get money from the fiscal disparities pool stay whole. So it's really the CI properties metro-wide that are out anything, and it's not held back anything from other municipalities, which is really the same mechanism that was used in the repayment program.
So, Representative Carlson, I think the answer is there's not a cost per capita. Mr. Michael, is that correct?
That's right. Mr. Chair, that's right.
Competition.
There's no one paying anything back.
Mr. Hines, thank you.
This is the only.
Mr. Chairman, there's a number of Senate provisions now that most do not have a comparable House provision. Section 16 of Article 5 in the Senate is the Aggregate Resource Preservation Property Tax Law. It's analogous to Green Acres for agriculture. And if there is a commercial aggregate deposit and the owner has a restrictive covenant and applies to the assessor, essentially the property is valued ignoring the value of the aggregate deposit until such time as it's going to be developed. More details if people are interested, I guess. I guess one additional note on that is that county governments must opt out in the first 2 years after the effective date of the program. Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions on that, moving on to Section 17 of the Senate, it's real estate exclusively devoted to soccer to the list of properties qualifying for open space property tax treatments. Section 18 of the Senate in Article 5, conservation easements. The Senate bill provides that Mr. Chairman, under current law, the language says that the property subject to conservation easement it's a reduction in value. This says that the property value may be adjusted, not necessarily, it could be increased or decreased. This house also has an analogous provision.
Mr. Chairman, the House language just changed a shall to may, whereas the Senate language has, you know, more language that provides this adjustment by the assessor based on the terms of the use restriction. And this is one of the provisions in that this morning when staff met and pulled together several sections that we included, and we included that, or that the Senate Section 18 is the preferable, and that's the preferable department provision, too.
Is that like the law? Or the department?
Mr. Chairman, Section 20 of the Senate bill reinstates a provision that was referred to as homestead borrowing that was in effect prior to the 2001 tax bill. Basically, a situation where a property is both homestead or not, both homestead and non-homestead, like a residence above a hardware store type of a situation. If the value of the homestead portion was less than $76,000, value would be borrowed from the commercial or whatever to make up that $76,000. It reduced the total tax capacity of the property that was eliminated in 2001, and this would reinstate homestead borrowing as it was at that time. The next section, Mr. Chairman, we mentioned briefly yesterday the relative homestead registration, and just requires in cities with population over 25,000 that relative homesteads rentals need to be registered with the city. The next three sections.
Mr. Chair, on Section 21, did we talk about this yesterday as we were going through?
Yeah.
It was like a house bill.
It was our effort to try to deal with that. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Sections 29 through 31 are the state general levy provisions of the Senate bill. basically does three things. It eliminates seasonal recreational property from the tax base for the state general levy. It also freezes the tax rate under current law. Mr. Chairman, the general levy is based on a dollar amount, which is indexed for inflation. The rate has been declining over time, and this would freeze the rate at the point it was at in 2004, which was 54.109%. Section 30 strikes the exemption for electric generation machinery, which is currently exempt from the state general levy. That would now be subject. Section 31 is just a under current law, the state levy is split into two pools between seasonal and commercial, and because we're getting rid of the seasonal from the general levy, that seasonal pool is eliminated. It would all be commercial. Mr. Chairman, sections 36 and...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Margaret.
On that state levy, first of all, that $30 million that now would go to seasonal rec would go on to the commercial industrial. I presume the pot would, well, actually, I guess the pot would get a little bit.
I would guess it's a dollar amount indexed for inflation, so it would shift under other CI property.
Mr. Chairman, I guess you could try to isolate that one piece. I mean, what we're doing is when we freeze the rate, we're increasing the state levy substantially. Taking out the seasonal rec brings that down somewhat, so there's a net reduction against what we're increasing it by. And then also when we're subjecting electric generation machinery, that is like another $17 million. So those provisions have a net. I guess you could isolate the seasonal and say it's being paid for from the commercial. That's one way to look at it, certainly.
Mr. Chair, is there a reason why you froze it at the 04 rate, or was it to back into some numbers? I mean, why not 05 or 06 or carry on forward or... It's just, I mean, I understand. Was there a certain...
That's what we carried in the bill last year.
Well,
depends on how much money you want to raise.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, the rate has been declining since this was instituted, and we just kind of picked the middle year. If we could have gone back to 01, it would have been a much higher rate, but we didn't go back that far. We thought it would be moderate to just go back a couple of years. That way.
Should have really gone back to a one, so really.
I mean, it was the rate was
57
when it was enacted.
Mr. Chairman, it was 57.933 in taxes payable 02. That was the first year.
Mr. Chairman, how much more money did that generate in 2002 or the beginning rate?
Mr. Chairman, it's a substantial amount more money, but we didn't pursue an estimate on that. We could do that if the committee would like.
Senator Bonk.
Senator Marty, that's a good question. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If CI properties do what folks are projecting, we all know these are forecasts, but if the housing market softens and the CI value climbs and CIs do well. So the net effect of this provision would be that commercial industrial, by freezing the rate, would pay significantly more into the state coffers through the state general levy. Is that right? I mean, just projecting, let's say the CI market just takes off.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, when the rate is frozen, then the additional tax base will be subject to the fixed rate. And so, yes, the levy would go up significantly.
Madam Chair, it treats commercial industrial property the same as every other class of property. I mean, if your market value goes up, your share of the tax burden probably goes up. But in the case of CI, they have this preferential treatment for the state general tax where their tax only goes up by an inflation index. No other property owner gets the opportunity to have a portion of their property taxes just adjusted for the rate of inflation. Nobody. Cabin owners would love that, to have their property taxes adjusted for the rate of inflation.
Mr. Chair,
I think
I agree on that part. However, we don't
freeze rates on other properties. We allow the rates to adjust relative to what cities and counties levy and what they feel the needs are.
But this tax is much like the class rate that they pay on the other portion of their property taxes. It is fixed at a rate. On the rest of their property tax, there's a class rate they pay.
Well, they've got that too, though.
But they don't pay a class rate on this portion. They just have an inflation index. I think as you think this through, you're going to find a way to think the Senate has great wisdom.
Senator Bach, you told me that, I guess my concern, honestly, is, you know, already CI has a much higher classification rate than other properties, and so they pay more as a percentage of their value than other properties, and it's a very regressive tax. So you, I think you had mentioned to me that there might be some other information available on regressivity of business tax, and I'd be interested in taking a look at that because, you know, when we look through the business or through the Department of Revenue's incident study, and when we hear from groups both sides of the aisle, you know, most people view these taxes as regressive. So, if there's anything later you can share with us to convince the House, I'd be interested in learning more about that.
Sir, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lonchesky. The only thing I would add to that is when you look at the runs, which we are getting for you, the runs we're using. The top tier CI is actually projected to receive a reduction. The first tier, I think it's a 0.6% increase from projected to 0.25 or something like that. It's relatively minor increase in the bottom tier and actually a reduction in the top tier.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I keep hearing last year and this year, and the governor keeps talking about property tax freezes, and Pocono was talking about property tax freezes, and I just kind of thought that freezing the CI statewide tax rate was a good way to freeze some property taxes. Might make them happy, maybe. Could use some of the money for residential property tax.
You know, I just think the 2001 bill had, I think they erred in this, and I actually told Senator Folgemiller that he was the chair of the Senate Tax Committee at the time, and I told him my hope was that I could fix this, and he says, well, I didn't vote for the 2001 bill, but I mean, he was sitting in this chair, I think, when the 2001 bill was done, and I do think we need to spend some time talking about this. I have read and heard people say that when you increase business property taxes, that those costs are just passed on dollar for dollar, that the consumer actually pays the bill. And I'm just not quite willing to buy into that. And we're going to look and see if we can find a little information on that. Because I got a pretty good feeling that if we raise property taxes on one of the large commercial industrial properties we have in Minnesota, pick one, Walmart, Home Depot, Wells Fargo, some big company that has buildings all over the country. I'm just not sure. Let me use Wells Fargo as an example because I can see it right out of my window. I'm not sure if we raise the property taxes on that building that those costs are all just passed on in new transaction costs to the people that bank with Wells Fargo in Minnesota. I think in the corporate office somewhere, are they in California? Where's Wells Fargo?
I think they are.
San Francisco?
I think it's.
I mean, there are a lot of things going on relative to Wells Fargo's corporate structure in every state they operate in. And I just don't think in Minnesota they operate in a vacuum here, and that if somehow their property tax burden goes up, those costs directly get passed on to customers in Minnesota. I just think there's a lot more going on in large corporations. So And I just don't think it's fair to say that those costs are all directly passed on. Does the consumer ultimately pay for it?
Yes.
Consumers pay for all business taxes. They pay for all business costs, inputs, everything. Ultimately, the consumer pays for everything. But I'm not sure there's a dollar-for-dollar pass-through. I'm just not convinced that it's as regressive as people might say that it is, because I'm just not sure that all of it is passed through. And I know Senator Scoy has been doing a little work on this to try and figure out how much, if we do raise business property taxes, how much. Let me use 3M for an example. My father-in-law, who recently passed away, worked there 42, 43 years. I think if we were to raise 3M's property taxes, I'm just not sure that it gets passed through in the cost of Scotch tape to Minnesota customers. I got a feeling some of that cost gets spread to 23 other states, to 60 other countries. I just haven't been convinced yet that it's a dollar-for-dollar pass-through to Minnesota citizens. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question about the tax incident study and their assumptions. Are they assuming 100% of business taxes are passed on? Because you're mentioning how some of it is passed on to other states and perhaps other countries. I think even in terms of when we talked about a few years ago when we were talking about rental property taxes and whether, well, if we cut the rental property taxes, they'll all be passed on to either reduced rents or better quality of housing. And I've always believed some of it is passed on, but is all of it, and so I guess my question is, do we know if Department of Revenue's tax incident study assumes a certain percentage is passed on, or is the calculation that 100% of it's passed on?
Mr. Manson, do we know?
Well, and Dr. Wilson is the guy right there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the tax incident study does not assume that it's 100% passed on to consumers. It is based upon some economic theories that can be questioned, so I don't want to make the assertion somehow that it's obvious that it's correct. But we try to take into account the differences between different kinds of businesses. 3M, for example, manufacturing a product selling out of state. To a large extent, selling in a national market, you're not going to pass that on higher prices to out-of-state consumers. If you put a tax on a grocery store, presumably grocery stores, if they can't pass it on, they're not going to make as much money, and so you may have fewer grocery stores, at least in an urban area. But to a larger extent, that'll get passed on to consumers than somebody like 3M. So it depends upon the type of market that they're operating in, and we vary the assumptions based upon the type of market. The other thing is that to some extent, if you can't pass it on to consumers, then the question is, does the investor take a lower rate of return or not? The investor does have a choice of moving elsewhere in some cases. And so to some extent, some of it also gets passed on to labor if there's less business in Minnesota, some of it could be passed backward toward labor as well. So the assumption is that some is labor, passed backward to labor, some is passed forward to consumers, some is passed, is borne by the owners of the company, the stockholders, if it's a corporation. I would say that in some cases, quite a bit of the tax can be exported because stockholders don't tend to be Minnesota residents. So that a lot of that tax can be exported in some cases to non-residents.
Senator Bach.
Representative Kessler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and on that, I mean, I think that last point was important because, you know, we're talking about shifting the tax incidence burden into cost, but there's also shifting backward in wages, labor. And then there is some component that probably gets eaten by the person who owns the business. I don't know. And maybe they make a location decision, but I think the export issue is separate from the incidence issue, and you know, definitely different industries have the ability to export this cost in a way that I guess we could say, well, if they cut workers' wages or lay off people in other states, or they shift those costs of those taxes to people in other states, we don't care as much. I mean, we could make that argument, but I think there's a myriad of businesses. Some can do shifting and some can't. Some can do
how much they can export the tax is different too, and maybe that's the piece that Senator Skoy is working on. I mean, I have not seen anything about, you know, which kinds of companies really are able to export new burdens, whether they come in commercial industrial property taxes or any other kinds of taxes. So, you know, we would be interested in the House in seeing that, because the House has spent a lot of time, whether it's with growth and justice a few years ago or tax incidence report, conservative to liberal groups, and seems the data is pretty solid that these are regressive taxes and we're trying to move more progressively. So if you can refute that with us, we're interested in your information, because I have not seen anything like that, and maybe sometime later we can learn more.
It'd be interesting to know that if we took the Senate provision, maybe we could have somebody monitor whether the price of a Big Mac goes up or not.
No, it's not all prices, though. It's wages as well. I don't know.
There it all for Denny. Mr. Paulson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, sections on page 29, sections 36 and 37 of the Senate bill expand the Metropolitan Transit Taxing District to include the entire seven-county metropolitan area. Sections 38 and 39 have to do with levy limits for hospital districts. Basically, they're eliminating specific limits for two districts, the Cook Oar Hospital District and the Cook County Hospital District, and moving those to the general levy limitation. And it also changes some restrictions on the levy for the Cook Oar Hospital District. Section 40, Mr. Chairman, is the education improvement account, and it takes $78 million of proceeds from the state general levy to be deposited in the education improvement account and taxes payable 2009 and 2010. Thereafter, it's $84.3 million for that account.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Marquardt.
Is this reinstating what was originally in that state general levy, where you had that educational account that was put away for the inflation that initially was put in there? Or does this has to do with part of your education plan? Where is this?
Mr. Chair, this is part of the money that the Education Committee has used in their levy buy-down.
This is some of the business general levy that we raise. We put into this account $78 million of the business property tax that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. We put it into this account, and the Education Committee does a consolidated levy. And we buy it down with this pot of money, so that even though there is a new consolidated levy on all general ed levy, this money allows it to be bought down, so there is actually a reduction in school taxes that are levied. And we use the business property tax to do that money. Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, this does not reinstate the language that was in the 2001 bill that took any growth in the education in the state general levy and put it into an education reserve account. That was repealed a few years ago. What this is doing is just taking a specific dollar amount and putting it into this account without regard to how much the state levy is growing by.
It's a school levy by now.
Sounds like a dedication.
So, Mr. Chair, in your education, what is the total levy decrease? I thought I saw when I was looking at the spreadsheet, it was 105 or 110. Is that the net?
It's this plus. Yeah, it's a little bit over 100 okay. Total levy buy down. And this is 78 of it.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, this is a piece of our property tax relief.
Yeah. Makes sense.
78 the first year and 84.
Mr. Chairman, Section 41 of the Senate bill requires the Commissioner of Revenue to develop a method of valuing agricultural property that reflects the actual value of the property, and the date is October 1st. The Commissioner must make recommendations to the tax committees of the House and Senate.
So Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and members, this is an important component of the Green Acres Commission. In order for Green Acres to work, you have to have a workable, accurate method of valuing agricultural property. This is what this is about.
Representative Marquardt.
Oh, well, we still have to go back to page 11.
Right, correct.
Okay, there you go. Okay, just a reminder.
Senator Skoy, anything more to add on?
Nope.
Okay, perfect. Mr. Manson, how much work is that for the department?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we've
they were doing
taken a hard look at it.
Have you been, I think?
Resources, but it's just another on the list of studies.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Manson, from my discussions with Mr. Folkman, the department was doing this. Anyway, we were just kind of asking him to have a kind of a time certain to get the results. When we started this session, discussions, we actually thought we might have some mechanisms that they would have had progress on by now, but they aren't. It doesn't sound like. But I think you've got some information standing behind you that's going to help. But I think the department's working on this.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we're fine with the study. We think it's a good idea. We do have some concerns about the language that reflects the actual value of the property. Actual reading of that language, we might prefer that be stricken and that we just look at the proper method of actually valuing these ag properties rather than actual value.
Sir Marty.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the actual value language sounds like it could be the language of the land it is developed. Agricultural property.
Exactly. Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Manson, if there's some language improvements, we certainly would be willing to take a look at those changes.
The repealer, Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chairman, the last section in the Senate's property tax article, first two have to do with seasonal rec because we're getting rid of that class, so there's no need for the definition of seasonal recreational property for the state levy or for penalty provisions. And then the last section eliminates a prohibition for the Met Council to levy transit taxes outside of the transit taxing district as it was defined in 2001. That last provision works with sections 36 and 37 that expand the Metropolitan Transit Taxing District.
Representative Lancheski, the Metropolitan Transit Taxing District, are you carrying that in the transportation bill? I think we're probably carrying it in both places.
Senator Bach, members, we're going to have the bonding for the transit stuff in our public finance bill. I'm not sure where that is. Mr. Michael,
we got.
I don't know that we have it.
This allows the additional bonding to be spread on a larger tax base. Yeah.
Senator Bach, and I don't really understand that provision. I wish somebody, maybe Senator Larson, somebody on transportation maybe understands this. There's some argument as to what the right boundary is and does it take in the metro transit ways and various cities, and I am unfamiliar with that. But there is some controversy there, and I don't understand it.
Well, as I understand it, there are some areas currently being served by transit, but they're not subjected to the levy.
Well, and Senator Bach, there are opt-outs. And opt-outs, they opt out of the system, and they're not subject to the levy, but they also pay locally on the property tax for their service. So I'm not sure if maybe we need to hear from some of those folks another time, but it may be that they're saying, look, we're already buying our own service, and now you want to make us buy this. I don't know. I that's why I'm looking at Senator Larson as someone who serves on transportation. I don't know if anyone else here does.
Senator Larson, do you remember?
Well, Mr. Chair, in addition to that, Representative Lancheski, it's in probably perpetually will be the problem of the boundary, wherever the boundary is. Folks that live outside the boundary but use the service inside the boundary is part of where the controversy lies. And so you can live outside the boundary and not be paying the tax, but park and ride to where the service is available and pay the subsidized fare.
I get it.
This was in the Senate transportation bill. I don't know if it's in yours, but maybe you'll. Mr. Michael, have you ever seen it?
I don't believe it's in the tax bill, but I don't know if it's in any bill anywhere. I don't think we've got it at all.
I'm familiar with the issue, and you've described it well. Mr. Chairman, there is a flip side to some in those areas where they don't get service, don't feel they should pay, but not recognizing the fact that their neighbor may be doing exactly what you're describing.
I know. When Senator Murphy brought the transportation bill to the tax committee, we had a discussion about carrying the bonds in the tax bill in the public finance article, and we do that, I believe. So I believe it was $44 million of bonds. And then the companion language with it was this piece, so we decided we should carry both pieces, the bonds and the expanded taxing area. Senator Larson, is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's right in the motion.
Well,
Representative Hornstein's carrying it in the House, and we will be putting the bonding, the local bonding, the Met Council bonding piece in our public finance bill, which we have not yet passed. But I don't know about that companion language, so I apologize.
We do have it in our public finance article here in the bill, so maybe you can check and see if
it's not in.
We're going to have to look into that.
Because if we carry the bonding, I think there's some kind of an agreement that the taxing jurisdiction expand if the additional bonding is authorized. I don't serve on transportation, but Senator Larson, is that, I think, what we've heard?
I believe so, Mr. Chair. That's absolutely.
But they did the additional bond.
Yeah, we haven't passed it yet.
No. Right, holds down the costs. Maybe we can have council find out first the rationale of expanding the district at the same time we're increasing the bonding authority.
Senator Bach, Mr. Michael thinks that we might have a different number. You have $44 million, and he thinks we might be at 38. So we might have to
find that at the same time.
Maybe that's the. Yeah, speculating now. Maybe that's it. You're willing to go up and take in, and we're not going up because we're not taking in. I don't know. Pure speculation. I'll check with Representative Hornstein and see what I can learn.
So while we have one piece of business left. Before we adjourn, and that concludes Article 3. Mm-hmm. So maybe when we hand the gavel over, Representative Lanchester, we can start with Article 4 tomorrow.
Let's do that. Yep.
Let's back up to page 11, Senator Moy.
I'm there, Mr. Chair.
Section 15 on page 11. We thought we should wait for you to be here to have a discussion about this.
I appreciate that.
We thought you had some interest in it.
Yeah, I have been in conversation with Representative Hillstrom. I understand from her that this bill, this portion of the House bill, came through as a result of some special issues in her area. And I believe both Representative Marquardt and Representative Lancheski, or Chair Lancheski, has been on a site visit to this particular, not you, Representative Marquardt, on a site visit to this particular area. And so I'm sympathetic to her desire to want to address this issue, but I've also been having some conversations with the department as well as with the different housing advocates, and they've all been giving me some feedback that there's some concerns about how you would actually implement this program. And so I'm wondering if the committee desires to hear, I don't know, and I've asked the department to give me some feedback on how the mechanics of it. I mean, how do you go on, get enrolled 1 year, and then if you somehow don't keep up with the crime-free program, then you go off, and then how do you get back on? I mean, the mechanics of enrolling in the program and getting off the program and not enrolling in the program. So I'd like a little bit more information, a little bit more of an opportunity to discuss, and if the committee would like to hear,
you know, I'm okay. Otherwise, I'd be more than glad to continue to have conversations with Representative Hillstrom and the housing folks and the department. I think in the end, you know, we might want to think about, and other cities have raised concern that if this goes into effect, it might create a disincentive for 4D people to want to enroll in the program. And so I'd like an opportunity to look at this a little bit more and see if we can more narrowly tailor the solution to address Senator Representative Hillstrom's concern, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Moy, I appreciate that. We certainly don't want to do anything that pushes people away from constructing 4D housing. And I'm a little interested, Senator Representative Marquardt, do we know if a property loses its 4D classification and then as a result pays higher property taxes, how do they then adjust rates, rental rates, if people are tied into rental contracts and pretty soon, you know, probably a significant property tax increase that I would think that the owner of the building is going to want to recover through their rents. I think, did we have any discussion about that on the House side?
Mr. Chair, no, not in that issue specifically. Now, it would be, you've got basically 2 years to get into the program. After 1 year, if you don't, or if you're not in compliance, you get a notice, and then you have another year to get into compliance and so forth. But as you mentioned, Representative Hillstrom had some real concerns in Brooklyn Center, where she's at. And she thought by lowering this from 75 to 20 now in our bill, that there was also a responsibility, or there might be a situation where you've got some landlords and owners who simply are not keeping some of these facilities up. And so now this would only apply to those cities that have a crime-free rental housing program, and then would only apply to those properties that police and sheriff calls are more than 25% above the average per unit, for example, calls. And also with that, emergency calls and domestic abuse calls, of course, would not count against that number because we want people calling in on those situations. So those would not count. So this mirrors many of the rental unit ordinances around the state that cities have. And I don't know for sure how many cities have the program. I know in Dilworth, Moorhead had one. We had one. So I'm very familiar with how this works. And but I understand the senator's concerns here, and I think we need to. I think we need to get everybody's viewpoint on this because it's not a clear cut deal by any means.
Anything else, Larson? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to raise an issue about. I believe Senator Betzold and maybe Representative Hillstrom have a provision, I believe, in the public finance bill that's also in this bill related to employer trusts for health care costs. And,
how long are you going to be?
And I'm wondering if the State Government Conference Committee, I think, has an interest in knowing if that provision is likely to travel in this bill. Has Senator Betzold visited with you, Senator Bach?
No.
Because I believe the House state government bill included that provision, if I'm not mistaken, in Representative Kahn's bill related to employee trust.
Senator Vaughn.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Larson and members. We just heard that bill from Representative Hillstrom yesterday, I believe. And we may be carrying it in the public finance bill, which I understand is in on this side in the tax bill. So I think it's being moved to us so that it can be dealt with in the tax conference committee, is my understanding. But we have not marked up an omnibus public finance bill yet. We have one more bill to hear. We're going to do that later this week, or two more, and then we'll get that done and we'll be on our way.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Senator Larson,
as a member of the Government Finance Conference Committee, I've been charged with finding out where that provision will reside in the end, if in fact it stays in play in that conference committee. And it's going to be a resolution.
Representative Lenchesky, did you know that Senator Larson was going to do such heavy lifting in the Senate when he came here to serve on two major conference committees?
I did. Yes, I knew. Of course. I know Senator Larson, and he's always capable. Senator Bach and Representative Larson, I should say, Representative Dabney might want to get in on this. The issue was not without controversy, as we talked about it yesterday. And so I would not want to guess for sure what will happen in Texas with Representative Hillstrom's bill. I know there were members like Representative Mullery and Representative Kahn even came and testified. Right, Representative Simpson? Representative Kahn came and testified to the tax committee about that provision. So I can't guarantee that I know what will happen, but I think the intent is for it to be carried in the public finance bill in the House.
Anything else, members?
Senator Bach.
Just anything else? Yes.
You know, we're trying to figure out, the House meets in session at 10, and the Senate at 1.
30.
Do we think we could do a little work between those two, or do we think that's unrealistic? Whatever people want to do. Of course, we can't control when we get off the floor, but we could.
I mean, I'm willing to come in before, I mean, after the House adjourns until the Senate starts and then recess. If you think there's time to do that, I don't know how long you're going to be on the floor, but.
We don't either, but.
Deal with that.
If there's a time.
So the intent would be to meet tomorrow and try to meet after the House adjourns and before the Senate convenes, and then recess and come back after the Senate adjourns. Is that what we're thinking? Work for members before I give her the gavel. Does that work?
If it doesn't work, we'll change. We'll post.
Worst case scenario, we'll meet after the Senate adjourns. Anything else? Anybody? Revenue? Anything else? How are we doing?
Good. Really close.
Committee's adjourned.
That's off.